Children's Day.
My question is, favourite pasta, with sauce or without sauce? What's the best burger you have ever had?
The Kitchen Cabinet with me, Jay Rayner, is on Saturday mornings at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And this is BBC Radio 4. Hello, it's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 13th of November. This is Today with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan.
Good morning. There are calls for other senior members of the Church of England to be held accountable for an abuse scandal after Justin Welby's resignation as Archbishop of Canterbury. I'll be speaking to the Archbishop of York, Stephen Cottrell. And underperforming NHS managers will be sacked and hospital league tables published as part of the government's plans to improve the health service in England. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, will be joining us live at 10 past eight.
Also in today's programme, Elon Musk has been picked to lead a newly created department of sorts in the Trump administration.
Only a decade ago, we were quite close with our political belief systems. And if you would have told me a decade ago that this would be the path of Elon Musk, I would have laughed and said zero chance.
The Booker Prize goes for the first time to a book set in space. Its author will join us live at 20 past eight. And the new British editor of Vogue, Choma Nardi, tells us she's concerned about a return of very thin models in fashion.
I do think perhaps Ozempic has something to do with it. We're in this moment where we're seeing the sort of pendulums swing back to skinny being in, and often these things are treated like a trend, and we don't want them to be.
The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
Survivors of abuse at the hands of John Smythe have called for senior clergy in the Church of England who knew about his behaviour to join the Archbishop of Canterbury in standing down. Justin Welby resigned yesterday after being criticised for failing to ensure allegations against Smythe were thoroughly investigated. Our religion editor Ali McBull reports.
Already, survivors of John Smythe's abuse, who did feel Justin Welby should step down for not doing enough and not earlier acknowledging what they'd been through, are asking questions about other clergy implicated. Four sitting bishops were named in the review of the church's handling of the case as knowing about the abuse long before it was made public and before it came to an end. Among them, the Bishop of Lincoln, Stephen Conway, has issued an apology for not taking further action, but later said that action should mainly have been to push for the office of Archbishop Welby to do more. Some survivors have asked for more resignations, and not just for the poor handling of John Smythe, but the cases of other abusers as well.
League tables are to be introduced for hospitals in England. Managers who persistently fail to improve performance won't get pay rises or will be replaced. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, says his plans mean there will be no more turning a blind eye to failure. Two NHS organisations have expressed concerns about the approach. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
In his first set-piece speech on NHS reform, Mr Streeting will say he aims to ensure every penny of extra investment in England's health service will be well spent and will cut patient waiting times. Senior health managers who don't meet targets and improve patient care will be denied wage increases. The best-performing trusts will be given more funding for buildings and equipment and control over how to use it. Failing organisations will be scrutinised and managers may be replaced. Hospital league tables will be published based on a range of performance indicators, which have yet to be fully spelt out. Trusts will be barred from hiring agency staff in some roles, including junior healthcare assistants. Mr Streeting will speak at a conference run by NHS providers representing trusts, which has warned that league tables could bring unintended consequences. Another employers group, the NHS Confederation, said staff should not be made to feel they were being named and shamed.
Donald Trump has nominated a presenter on the television channel Fox News to serve as the US Defense Secretary in his new administration. He's also confirmed that the tech billionaire Elon Musk will have a job working alongside the businessman Vivek Ramaswamy. Our North America editor Sarah Smith reports from Washington.
Donald Trump is making clear he intends to entirely reshape the American government by appointing Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy to drastically reduce government spending, slash regulation, and dismantle government bureaucracy. Mr. Trump has also named Peter Hegseth as defense secretary. He's an Army combat veteran who spent the past 8 years working as a presenter on Fox News. He has no experience in government And Mr. Hegseth may run into opposition from senior military leaders and might struggle to have his appointment confirmed in the Senate.
The government says it's working to ensure physician associates are supporting rather than replacing doctors after concerns were raised about patient safety. The role requires only 2 years medical training. BBC News has seen evidence of physician associates covering some doctor shifts in NHS trusts in England. Ruth Clegg reports.
Physician associates, or PAs for short, have been supporting doctors in the NHS for more than 20 years. But it is only over the past 2 years that their numbers have more than doubled. There are now more than 3,000, with plans to increase that to 12,000 by 2036. BBC News has spoken to the family of a great-grandmother who died after a physician associate left a drain in her abdomen for 15 hours longer than it should have been. The PA had been passed as competent by a specialist nurse who mistakenly believed he was a doctor. The General Medical Council says patient safety will improve when it regulates physician associates next month, and NHS England says it has issued updated guidance on their role.
Senior executives at social media companies could face fines if they fail to stop illegal knives being advertised on their platforms. The government wants to bring in the measure to help meet its target for halving knife crime over the next decade. Police would be able to issue notices ordering the executives of online firms to take down illegal content within 48 hours or face being personally fined. The government's expected to commission a review of how train companies enforce fares after concerns were raised about some passengers being treated too harshly. BBC News understands the Transport Secretary Louise Hague will ask the rail watchdog to investigate the use of criminal prosecutions. The judges of the Booker Prize have described this year's winning novel Orbital as a book about a wounded world. It was written by Samantha Harvey and follows fictional astronauts on the International Space Station. Our culture editor, Katie Razzle, reports.
Samantha Harvey, the only British writer on the shortlist, called winning the £50,000 prize something beyond anything she could imagine. Her novel, Orbital, unfolds over a single day in space as six astronauts on the International Space Station witness 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets as they circle the Earth. The judges praised its ambition and Harvey's ability to make our world strange and resonant.
And an expert has shed light on the mystery surrounding a suspected Russian spy. A beluga whale named Hvaldimir was found in 2019 off the coast of a Norwegian island wearing a harness described with inscribed with the words Equipment St. Petersburg. Now a scientist specialising in whales says it appears the animal escaped from a Russian naval base in the Arctic Circle.
Thanks very much, Alan. It is 7 minutes past six. It's time for the weather forecast. So let's hear what Stav Donais has for us over at the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning, Stav.
Good morning to Emma and Amal. Thank you very much. The weather is remaining very quiet over the next few days with high pressure close by. Pretty much business as usual has been for the last 2.5 weeks. During the weekend, though, conditions will change. It's going to turn more unsettled, low pressure developing. It'll bring some rain and also stronger winds, particularly on Sunday. As that pulls out, it will open the floodgates to an Arctic northerly. So next week looks a lot colder for all of us. There will be a chance of some sleet and snow showers in places, mainly over hills across northern areas. But there will be some sunshine, but nights will be cold and frosty. Today, though, we're in that quieter spell with high pressure around. It's a chillyish start, particularly where skies are clear, but mist and fog has developed where skies cleared overnight. So some areas starting really cloudy and foggy through this morning. Scotland and Northern Ireland will stay mostly cloudy today. The best of any sunshine here will be across eastern Scotland through the day. Western Scotland, Northern Ireland will stay rather grey and misty, and we'll even see some patchy light rain at times. England and Wales, cloudy with mist and fog, particularly across northwest England and Wales, and a few across the West Midlands into the southwest too. Few places in the areas I've mentioned will stay cloudy all day, and probably the best of the sunshine will be towards southern and eastern England, where temperatures will reach highs of around the low teens. Winds will be lighter today than what they were yesterday across the southeast, so light winds across the board thanks to high pressure, and I can remember those temperatures 11 to 14 degrees, but it turns cloudier for Thursday and Friday with limited sunshine. I'll have more for you later.
Stav, thank you very much indeed. Look forward to chatting to you later. Let's have a look now at this morning's papers and what is on various news websites. The vacancies created by the departures of Justin Welby and Gary Lineker create the bulk of the headlines. The Daily Mail says the resignation of the Archbishop of Canterbury because of his handling of child abuse allegations against John Smythe
has left the Church of England in turmoil. The Times notes that while Archbishops of Canterbury have been murdered and executed since the first in 597 AD, Welby's resignation on a matter of negligence is historic and without exact precedent.
The editorials are universal in their view that Justin Welby had to resign, finally, declares the Daily Express, while the Daily Mirror says he was left with no choice but to go. The Sun said his position had become wholly untenable. The Daily Telegraph leader highlights what it calls a damning epitaph for Justin Welby, with one cleric saying he could not think of an archbishop who had caused such damage to the church since the Reformation.
Who's in the frame to take the C of E's top job, asks The Guardian. The paper offers seven options, including Stephen Cottrell, the Archbishop of York, who's joining us at 10 to 8, and Gully Francis Decani, the Bishop of Chelmsford. The Eye suggests that a candidate could also be drawn from the Episcopal Church, the Church of Ireland, or the Church in Wales, and the Daily Mail leader says the new Archbishop must focus on the spiritual and pastoral needs of their flock and not bleat constantly about the sins of the fathers.
Moving to the Eye paper, it reports that Gary Lineker's departure from Match of the Day was in part because of internal frustration that his podcasting business was driving audiences away from the BBC. Under his new deal, the corporation will post an edition of his The Rest Is Football podcast on BBC Sounds. The Daily Telegraph points out that while BBC listeners will get the podcast ad-free, they will have to wait 48 hours after it has been made available elsewhere.
With the Daily Mirror reporting that Gary Lineker is at peace with the decision over his future, I don't know why that's funny, but it's quite a strange thing to say. There's much speculation about his successor on Match of the Day. The Daily Mail says the director of BBC Sport is already discussing Lineker's job with the host of Football Focus, Alex Scott. The Sun's lead says corporation bosses want Mark Chapman and Kelly Summers to take turns in the hot seat, but Mark Chapman is reportedly not keen on the idea. A source describes the row as a headache for the BBC.
Bringing it all together in some ways, under the headline How the Mitre Has Fallen, the Daily Express reminds its readers that Justin Welby was outspoken on issues including child poverty, the plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda and assisted dying. And the Daily Telegraph alludes to Gary Lineker's activism, including a monologue at the Qatar World Cup to criticise the country's human rights record. The paper's Matt cartoon is a meeting at a job centre with the caption reading, Match of the Day presenter, have you got anything less preachy like the Archbishop of Canterbury?
Time now is 12 minutes past six. Making government fun again. Just one of the posts written by Elon Musk, the head of X and Tesla, last night as Donald Trump gave him a job in his administration. And earlier, our North America correspondent David Willis told me this was news we knew was coming.
No surprises there, Amal. He was a staunch supporter of Donald Trump during the latter months of the presidential campaign, of course. And as expected, he's now been rewarded for his efforts with this quite high-profile advisory job. And together with fellow entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, who was one of Donald Trump's rivals, of course, for the Republican presidential nomination, Mr. Musk is to head what's been called the Department of Government Efficiency. Now, that's a newly created body that's expected to work with the White House to dismantle bureaucracy and basically foster a more entrepreneurial approach to government. Now, government spending in this country is thought to be around, $6.5 trillion a year. And Elon Musk has already gone on record as saying that he could find ways of saving nearly a third of that.
And give us a sense of some of the other appointments that we've heard, including the appointment of a Fox News host. He is a former army veteran, but he's essentially a Fox pundit as far as we can see, a chap called Pete Hegseth, who's now Defense Secretary of the United States.
That's right. Pete Hegseth is a complete outsider, but he takes on one of the major departments of government at a time of war in Europe and the Middle East, and as well as a budget of billions of dollars, he'll assume responsibility for more than 1 million active duty American troops.
And the central idea here, David, is basically loyalty is rewarded, and that includes ambassadorial appointments and also the new head of the CIA.
That's right. And indeed, the appointment of the South Dakota governor, Kristi Noem, as a Homeland Security Secretary. And of course, one of Donald Trump's chief priorities has been fortifying the southern border and deporting those who entered the country illegally. And Ms. Noem was the first state governor to send National Guard troops to Texas to help out with the surge in illegal border crossings there. But you're absolutely right. The common denominator among those named to top jobs so far in the federal government is clearly their loyalty to Donald Trump.
David Willis, good to talk to you. Thank you.
14 minutes past six, let's turn to this story that the government has told the BBC that it's urgently working with the NHS to ensure that physician associates, known as PAs, healthcare professionals within 2 years of medical training, that's what they are supporting and not replacing doctors. Ruth Clegg, a BBC reporter who's been looking into this story, joins us now. What are the issues with these PAs as they're known?
Yes, good morning, Emma. Even though PAs make up just such a small proportion of the NHS workforce, the debate around them has become increasingly toxic. Just to explain what a PA is, they have, like you said, 2 years' worth of medical training in comparison to the 7 years a typical doctor would get. And they're supposed to work under supervision to deliver that basic care. But doctors and consultants have told me that the lines between PAs and doctors are becoming increasingly blurred. And we've seen evidence of PAs covering doctor's shifts, prescribing medicine and ordering x-rays, all out of their remit. There's been several high-profile cases where patients have died after being treated by a PA. And I've been speaking to the family of a great-grandmother. She died after a PA left a drain in her abdomen for 15 hours longer than it should have been. And the family don't want to blame the individual PA. They say the system needs to change. They didn't even know that their loved one was being treated by a PA rather than a doctor. So they're backing a legal challenge by doctors and consultants who make up a campaign group called Anaesthetists United to get the role more clearly defined. So it's becoming a real headache for the NHS and the General Medical Council, who are due to regulate the role in December.
Also, the numbers growing like that and the sort of concerns of doctors are being heard as well, aren't they?
Yes, well, the number has grown. Over the past 2 years, it's increased. It's doubled to over 3,000. And the NHS long-term plan is to increase these roles to 12,000 by 2036. The General Medical Council says that patient safety will improve when they do regulate the role, but it's not giving a clear definition. It's leaving it to NHS Trust to decide what that role will be. Now, there's no denying that physician associates can provide that excellent service under the right supervision. But with the ongoing problems that we're seeing across the NHS and crucially those doctor shortages across hospitals and GP surgeries, there is that growing pressure on government to take action and provide more clarity around their role.
Yes. Ruth Clegg, thank you.
It is now 17 minutes past six, can you be pro-growth whilst raising taxes on business? Will Bain has been looking at that this week for us, whether in London or this morning, I believe, in Salford. Will, over to you.
Morning, Amal. Morning, Emma. Yeah, that's a question that's already come to kind of define the early relationship, hasn't it, between business leaders and Labour since their election win, or so it seems so. Back in May, Rachel Reeves promised to lead what she called the most pro-growth Treasury in our country's history if Labour won that election. But since the budget, businesses have been questioning just that. That date in May also saw more than 120 business leaders write to the Times newspaper, something we've covered here on the programme, to say they felt Labour had changed and wanted to work with business on long-term growth. One of those who signed that letter was Andy Higginson. Andy's the chairman of the sports fashion retailer JD Sports, and he's also the chairman of the British Retail Consortium. Andy, morning.
Good morning.
Have they lived up to that then, that pro-growth promise? And that central question we posed right at the top, can you be pro-growth and raise taxes?
So I think the first question, pro-growth and raise taxes, is possible, but I think it has to be done delicately and carefully. I think they came to business pre the election with a promise of economic literacy and being pro-growth, and they do need growth. If you're going to invest in public services, which they're also very open about rebuilding the public services, you do need to get that growth. And at the moment, it's hard to see that the actions so far really match that sort of pro-business rhetoric before the election. But there's plenty of time yet. There's a lot to be done. But if we're going to get that growth, we're going to need low inflation. We're going to need low business interest rates that come with that. We're going to need the funding that can come with business, and that means freeing up London and deregulating and so on. And then we need this taxation and fiscal environment that will encourage investment. And that's sort of worrying in the context of this budget.
You tell me the word frustration, confusion. Which is it, and what has caused it the most for retailers like you?
Well, I think it's the scale of all the increases that have come all at once. I think, you know, you've seen a bill for retail across national insurance, minimum wage, the changes to rates, which means rates are going up, despite the fact we were promised that rates would be coming down for retail. You're seeing a sort of $5 billion a year hit. And there's only two ways to deal with that. One is to cut back on investment, cut back on recruitment, cut back on headcount, cut back on jobs. And then secondly, to put up prices. And the one thing that will guarantee is that we will see inflation in retail prices coming from the things that are announced in the election. What we're calling for today is for the government to phase those increases in. If they want to bring those increases in to fill this gap in the public purse, to put the money into the public services that they promised to do, then do it on a phase basis so that we're not dealing with all of these kinds
of challenges. Over what kind of time period?
Over the next 2 to 3 years. I think, you know, you've got many more things coming down the track, and they can look at those and cancel some of those. I mean, you know, they've inherited the deposit return scheme, which is going to cost retail $2 billion a year. The packaging levy is going to cost us $2 billion a year. We've got their own employment's right bill, which is coming in a couple of years' time. And we just need to make sure that the immediate impact of all these things doesn't come in one big lump, and that the economy has time to absorb those changes in a way that doesn't fuel inflation, that doesn't undermine the thing. It's all very well giving people a 6.5% pay rise through the national minimum wage, but if at the same time inflation goes through the roof, it's not a real increase, is it?
You mentioned price rises and potentially cutting back on investment, closures potentially as well. Are they things that you're already thinking about at JD Sports?
Well, I don't want to talk specifically about JD Sports plans. I think it's a general issue for the whole retail industry. We are an industry that already pays way above our fair share in taxes. We're paying 7.5% of the business taxes when we're only 5% of the business economy. So we're paying, you know, over half as much more than we should be doing. Our effective rate of tax with rates and everything else at the moment is already 55%. Mm. So we're a big taxpayer. We're a big employer. And we are someone the government should be listening to. And I'm guaranteeing you today that if these go through as they are, without any sort of feathering, we're going to see significant inflation in prices.
The government talked in that letter that we talked about, though, as well, about fiscal discipline. I'm looking at the line right in it now on the Labour Party's website. Balancing the books is about fiscal discipline and difficult decisions. And Darren Jones on the Laura Koonsberg at the programme at the weekend saying that companies of the kind of size of yours are the ones who have, to paraphrase, got to suck it up.
Yeah, well, that's the sort of student union rhetoric that we hoped had long disappeared, really, from industry. You know, industry being successful is how the economy grows. And being successful is how we invest in businesses, how we employ more people, and how the whole thing goes. And that gives governments the flexibility to invest in the public services. They have a duty to manage that investment in the public services. But this government are clear that that's what they want to do, and we're supportive of that. Mm. But if you want the economy to grow and give them the headroom to do that, then you have to do this in a much more careful way than they're doing at the moment.
Sounds like those relationships are quite strained already.
No, I don't think so. It's very early days. You know, the government have a clear majority, and it's a government we want to work with over the next 5 years. But they also need to listen to the wise heads of old people like myself, who've been through and seen this and run big businesses. You know, we want to support. We want to be there. We want to be sort of investing in new growth. And we just want to help them get to the point where they can do that. And at the moment, the cumulative effect of all these changes is too much for industry to bear, in the sense of then being able to get on and invest and grow.
Andy Higginson, chairman of the British Retail Consortium, also chairman of the sports fashion retailer JD Sports, thanks so much for your time. Well, Anna McDonald, investment manager at Aubrey Capital Management, is with us to look through what else is moving financial markets this morning. Anna, morning.
Good morning.
And we heard a little bit there from David Willis talking about some of the Trump picks, the Trump cabinet picks, and that again, and the sort of sceptre of tariffs has been the kind of main dominant feature of the markets again in the last couple of days.
Yes, markets did head lower in the UK and Europe. Even there was some profit taking also in the US, and that's continued into Asia. I think what the markets are really reacting to is not only those appointments that seem to show that Trump really does mean business, and perhaps these baseline tariffs of 10 to 20% for even allies will actually come to pass, but also the bond market in the US, which, as you can imagine, is absolutely enormous, was closed for Veterans Day on Monday. So yesterday was the first chance that participants had to react to those Trump appointments. And we did see a spike in 10-year yields. So that means that borrowing costs in the US are rising. And that could be pretty bad news generally about how people feel about taking risks in the investments.
And in terms of company responses, I'm sure stuff like this is long in the planning, but interesting in the timing of the announcements. VW, Volkswagen, announcing a tie-up with Rivian, the big US electric mainly truck maker, sort of joint venture. Interesting timing.
Yes. Well, they have had a joint venture, and they've announced an increase in their investment. They think that by sharing their critical technology, the Rivian's critical technology with VW will continue to reduce the cost of development and scale the technology for VW more quickly. I mean, they've both been struggling, these companies. VW has been struggling with competition on China's Build Your Dreams and other of electric cars, which are much cheaper. And Rivian's never actually scored a profit. So, yes, I think by thinking they can get together, they'll be able to get some scale and some speed to their development of electric vehicles.
Beyond kind of companies reacting to US news, Vodafone shares were moving yesterday. Why was that?
Yeah, Vodafone fell about 8% yesterday. They had flagged a fall in their largest country sales, which is Germany. Regulators had banned the bundling of TV subscription services, which they sold alongside rent. And more than half of the households that were taking that product did actually cut that. So that's been an issue for Vodafone. They're also doing quite a lot of management around their assets and trying to merge with Three. So there is a lot going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. A company we're going to keep coming back to in this slot, I think, as you say, as that merger with Three moves a little closer. Anna, thanks so much for your time. Anna McDonald, Investment Manager at Aubrey Capital Management there. Well, a company that posted a third consecutive quarterly profit in the US last night was Spotify. It's on track to be in the black for the full year for the first time in its history. Will Page, former chief economist at Spotify, joins us. Will, morning.
Morning.
That would be quite some landmark.
It would be. Results are actually very impressive. Beats in terms of volume and in line on value. Just to give you a quick heads up, it's 640 million monthly active users for Q3 and a remarkable 252 million subscribers. That's over a quarter of a billion people paying for music. And you now got a gross margin that begins with a 31.1% gross margin. So really impressive results.
And that was a key, because a lot of people thought that we might have met saturation in this market.
I think we are actually seeing saturation, but we're seeing Spotify win out. The expression I like to use is herbivores are turning into carnivores. For 15 years, you've had streaming services all growing. Amazon's up, Apple up, YouTube is up, Spotify's up. Now we're at that point where the way that Spotify grows is to steal market share of its competitors. And I think that's beginning to happen.
And Spotify's, is that going to be about away. Pricing going forward?
Pricing's interesting, because we had the famous $9.99 price point for all of 23 years. And now you're beginning to see prices getting exercised. So Spotify is getting a little bit more expensive. And I think that pricing power is holding up. It can meet with demand as well. But you're also seeing audiobooks. That's a really important development, because that's contributing to gross margin too.
Yeah, how does it diversify, I suppose? How does it stand out compared to those competitors going forward, if that's the kind of next challenge that investors are looking at? Because it made that big bet on podcasts, didn't it? Backfired pretty badly. Where do you see it diversifying to?
Yeah, the old joke about podcasts. What's the best way to keep a secret? Put it in the second half of a podcast. the podcast bet didn't actually add much to gross margin as a story, but audiobooks will. So you spend more time on audiobooks, that's a higher gross margin business, which adds to Spotify's bottom line. So it's a positive gross margin story in audiobooks, and it's a positive story in pricing power as well. And that actually sets the gross margin story up well for the future.
Will, thanks so much for your time this morning. Will Page, the former chief economist at Spotify. And back to Amol Raj, and a man who I'm sure people listen to all the way through to his podcast, right to the very end, especially if anybody from higher up and the BBC is listening.
It depends on the podcast, doesn't it? But if it's called the Today Podcast, I can assure you, well, that's almost always true. Will Page and Will Bain, thank you both very much indeed. Stop laughing, Emma. At 28 minutes past six, it's time to say good morning to Mike Williams, who's got the sport.
I'm a subscriber, a loyal subscriber.
Come on.
New episode out tomorrow.
Part
of a growing club and community, Mike.
Community.
Thank you, Amal and Emma. Good morning. It is an important day in English football's journey to introduce a new independent regulator as the Football Governance Bill receives its second reading in Parliament today. Strengthened legislation to establish a body that will oversee the elite men's club game in England was relaunched by the government last month, and the House of Lords are set to scrutinise the proposals later today. Well, Rick Parry is chair of the English Football League. He hopes a seminal review of the game by the new regulator could help break years of deadlock between the EFL and the Premier League over the financial future of the two organisations.
This bill, from our point of view, is an improvement on the last one in three important respects for us. Last time we were disappointed that parachute payments had been completely excluded. We felt that was intellectually incoherent, it just didn't make sense to us. So the fact that they are now within the scope of the bill is important. We've been real enthusiasts about the state of the game review, a proper independent analysis of the game's finances. We were very disappointed again with the last bill that the regulator was going to be given up to 3 years to get the first one produced. We felt that was way too long. This government have reduced it to 18 months. And finally, again, one of the oddities of the previous bill was that the two leagues had the opportunity to contract out of the backstop completely. That has now gone, which we think, again, from our point of view, is a plus. So we're pleased.
We'll have more on this story and indeed from Rick Parry in the next hour of the programme. Meanwhile, in the Women's Champions League last night, Arsenal's impeccable form under interim manager René Sliger's continued with an impressive 4-0 win over Juventus in Italy. The French woman is now unbeaten and with four wins from five matches since she took temporary charge of the side last month.
Again, we have four different goal scorers and the players up top are performing really well, but I don't want to take out the goalkeeper, our back four and our two sixes as well, which we sometimes forget to highlight because the players up top are scoring the goals. But I think goalkeepers, back four, they have been doing really well now over time, and I think the whole team today deserves credit, and including the game changers coming on tonight.
The result leaves Arsenal second in their Champions League group. Manchester City, meanwhile, maintain their 100% record in the competition so far this season with a third win out of three. They beat the Swedish side Hammarby by 2-0 at home. And tennis's Billie Jean King Cup finals get underway later this afternoon. First match sees hosts Spain take on Iga Świątek's Poland. That one getting underway around 4 p.m. Great Britain play their first tie of the competition on Friday.
Thanks very much. Well, look who will be waltzing back onto the airwaves with this.
Hello and welcome to You Heard It Here First.
Chris McCausland on BBC Radio 4.
This is the show that asks our guests to live in an audio-only world,
where panellists use sound clues to work out what's going on.
Guess how this dog's feeling?
Constipated.
Yes, definitely.
Step what am I doing?
The hand dryer.
Is this the same dog?
You heard it here first with me, Chris McCausland.
Why are you so familiar with that sound?
Wednesday night, 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now the time is 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds with Emma Barnett and Amal Rajan. And here is a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Some survivors of abuse by John Smythe have called for more resignations in the Church of England. Yesterday, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, said he would stand down after a report highlighted decades of child abuse by Smythe, a barrister associated with the church. The inquiry into the church's handling of the case also named four serving bishops who it claims were aware of Smythe's abuse long before it was made public. Among them is the Lincoln's Stephen Conway, who has issued an apology for not taking further action, but later said that action should have been to press for Archbishop Welby's office to do more. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, will announce plans for hospital league tables this morning as part of measures to tackle poor performance in the NHS. At a conference in Liverpool, Mr. Streeting will also say that persistently failing managers will be replaced. The NHS Confederation said staff should not be made to feel that they were being named and shamed. Donald Trump has appointed the world's richest man, Elon Musk, as the joint head of the new US government efficiency department. He'll be given the job of cutting what Mr. Trump's team describes as wasteful expenditure and government regulations. The incoming president has also nominated the Fox News host and former military veteran Pete Hegseth as his defense secretary. The US State Department says it's confirmed that North Korean troops have begun engaging in combat operations alongside Russian forces close to the border with Ukraine. There's been no comment from Moscow or Pyongyang. Social media bosses who fail to stop illegal knives being advertised on their platforms could face heavy fines under new government plans. The Home Office says the measures would make tech executives personally liable as part of a crackdown on the illegal weapons market. And the British writer Samantha Harvey has won this year's Booker Prize for her novel Orbital. It follows six astronauts aboard the International Space Station over 24 hours. The judges said the story makes the world strange and new.
As we do every morning. Alan, thank you very much indeed. Samantha Harvey will be here, actually, in our studio talking to Emma at 20 past eight or so. But now let's turn to NHS reform, which we're speaking to Wes Treating about at 10 past eight. There are big reforms to be outlined in a speech today, and Hugh Pym, our health editor, can take us through some of them. And Hugh, the basic idea, which we have heard before, in fact, New Labour announced it in 2001, is league tables, ranking performance and financial incentives to climb up those league tables.
Well, that's right, Amol. We've had a lot of talk from Wes Treating and the Prime Minister about no money for the NHS without reform. We heard the money side of it in the budget, and now Wes Treating's making his first set-piece speech on NHS reform. Quite a lot's been trailed already, but he's pulling it all together. And yes, league tables will be an important part of that, listing all trusts in England by various performance metrics. Now, we haven't been told exactly what those metrics are. That is yet to be published. There'll be a new system on bosses' pay. At the moment, the NHS leadership sometimes are awarded simply if a hospital turnover gets higher and they've just taken on more work. What Mr. Streeting wants to see is a series of criteria which will highlight good performance, highlight bad performance, outcomes for patients, and how they're generally performing on waiting lists. Again, more detail is awaited on that. Failing trusts will be scrutinised very intensively, and managers will be moved on, dismissed and replaced if that's required. And more successful trusts will be given more control over their budgets, particularly capital spending. So there's a sort of reward element to this for the higher performing ones. And there'll also be more controls on agency spending, £3 billion a year being spent by the NHS in England. And there will be now a ban on taking certainly some of the more junior healthcare assistants on from agencies.
And the worry, of course, Hugh, is going to be, as we're going to hear at 10 past seven from perhaps Dr. Adrian Boyle, that this could really damage staff morale at a time when staff morale is already pretty low.
Yeah, well, Wes Treating's delivering his speech at a conference of NHS providers, which represents trusts in England. So there'll be a lot of senior NHS managers there listening to his tough message on pay and performance. And they've put out a statement saying, taking steps to resolve root causes of NHS problems, pressures and so on, is important before any plans to introduce league tables with threats to sack failing managers. And they also say league tables can bring significant risks of unintended consequences. The NHS Confederation and other employers' organisation saying naming and shaming is not the way to incentivise staff. And I think a problem with this sort of thing has always been, how do you encourage the best managers to go to the most challenged trusts and keep their careers on track? How do you encourage that? There have always been powers to go in and put trusts into special measures, but how do you take those trusts forward and maintain public confidence? And of course, winter is approaching with all the pressures associated with that. So there can be talk of reform, but there are certainly immediate challenges for NHS and managers, patients and staff in the months ahead.
Hugh Pym, our health editor, good to talk to you. Thank you.
At 22 minutes to seven, let's look at this story. A day after Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, resigned over his handling of the Church of England's worst child abuse scandal, becoming the first person in the role to be forced out of it in modern times, will other senior clergy now resign? And what is next for an institution described as being in turmoil this morning? Ali McBool, our religion editor, joins me now. What is the focus within the Church of England this morning?
Well, I think, Emma, a lot of people are taking stock at the moment. It's been an extremely turbulent time. A lot of people want to try to just take a breath and feel, some people feel, a line has been drawn under this, that the message is out there now, that you take abuse in the church seriously, you do everything you can, or it'll catch up with you. But there are others already, survivors, survivor groups, who are saying, well, if one person is gone for hearing about abuse and for not saying, look, where are the victims? Are they okay? Are we doing everything we can to stop the abuse? And following up on that, then there are others who should go too. And not just in this case, in the John Smythe case, the report came out last week, and it names lots of people over decades within the church who didn't do enough, including people in the 80s, for example, who it says were engaged in an active cover-up. But there are those more recently who have been called out, who are sitting, for example, bishops, four sitting bishops, who knew about the abuse long before it was put to an end and before it was made public. And so survivors are certainly, some survivors of John Smythe are certainly asking for those people also to consider their positions. But there are survivor groups looking at cases beyond that and saying, well, if this is what Justin Welby thought was the right thing to do, then others should think the same way.
John Smythe, you're talking there about the name of the abuser who did never face justice, we should say, and died in 2018. For those who perhaps aren't quite across each part of this story, we will be returning to it, not least to get the views of the Archbishop of York just before 8 o'clock. Aline McBull, our religion editor, thank you.
Let's turn to politics now with Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. And Henry, this, well, lunchtime today, midday, it's PMQs. Kemi Badenoch's first PMQs was somewhat overshadowed by the election of Donald Trump, and American politics has a habit of overshadowing the election of Tory leaders, because Ian Duncan Smith back in 2001 had to deal with 9/11. What do we think Kemi Badenoch's sort of approach might be in this PMQs, and indeed in her approach to leading the Conservative Party?
Yeah, it was striking last week, Amol, that not only was the news agenda dominated during Kemi Badenoch's first PMQs by the victory of Donald Trump, but she chose to use Donald Trump's victory to prosecute an argument against Keir Starmer that he kind of isn't serious, a student politician, as she claimed, citing David Lammy's historic tweets and so on, which he enjoyed, I think, responding to. This week, you may well get for the first time a clearer sense of the policy divides between the two of them, not least because we're expecting the policy divide between these two parties under these two leaders to be quite stark, starker than it has been for some years. You know, speaking to people in both parties, they say as a result of Rachel Reeves's budget, and also as a result of the Conservatives electing a leader who says that she believes the state should do less, you now do have two competing visions of what the state should be and what it should do. And that perhaps at PMQs and other fleeting opportunities where the leader of the opposition has the chance to grab the agenda, you might see a bit of Kemi Badenoch.
So it may be a smaller state on some economic issues. We know she feels strongly about cultural or socio-cultural issues. Based on her cabinet, based on the conversations that you're having, Henry, what do we know about what Badenochism really is?
Well, as you say, we know that she has a sort of series of dispositions, but almost one of the clearest divides between her and Robert Jenrick in the leadership campaign was not on policies, but on whether she ought to have policy at this point. And her view is that she should take the time to review things, to work out what the government should and shouldn't do. Even Conservative MPs who are pretty enthusiastic about her leadership are slightly wary of that. They do believe that as leader of the opposition, you've got to find a way to grab every opportunity you get. And PMQs, for example, is one of those. So I do wonder if this week or in the coming weeks, we'll see more clearly Kemi Badenoch trying to define what choices she would make that would be different from the Labour government's.
Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Let's return to the morning's pages, newspapers rather, in the front pages. Looking at the Daily Mail, church in crisis as Welby is forced to quit. Shamed Archbishop steps down over the handling of child abuse scandal. And if you go inside to what's been further written about this story, could we be about to get the first female
archbishop is another question when looking to who will succeed the Archbishop of Canterbury. Front page of the Daily Telegraph also leading with that story, and a striking image of Justin Welby with his head bowed. And to the Times, Welby quits in shame at child abuse failures, case failures, resignation without precedent, it says, in 1,427 years. And just also an excerpt, a very different nature, but Melania Trump's memoir, there's an exclusive excerpt, My Life with Donald. Having read that this morning, it's a very interesting read.
It's an interesting intervention by Gordon Brown in the Eye newspaper. So Gordon Brown now spends a huge amount of his time running something called multi-banks, which is not just food banks, but sort of social, it's a form of social activism, really. And he said to the Eye newspaper that he's very concerned about what's going on in poverty policy, particularly as it relates to child poverty. He says there's got to be a complete review of the child poverty policy, saying that child poverty has become a far bigger problem than pensioner poverty in recent years. He says we need a complete review of the system. That's going to happen in the next few months, but in the meantime, you can't let children suffer. You've got to do something about it. And worth just quickly mentioning the lead item in the FT's Lex column this morning about Donald Trump's relationship with the media. Basically, the conventional or traditional media had a wonderful time under Donald Trump's first presidency. New York Times subscriptions soared, CNN ratings went up, and the FT says that's not necessarily going to happen this time because power has so fundamentally shifted to social media and to alternative sources of information rather than the traditional media. But if you are going to invest in traditional media, you should do it because there's slightly too much of it and it's likely to get consolidated. So interesting analysis from Lex this morning.
Here on what some would call the traditional media there, but depends on how you view it. 7:15 last night, MPs voted to expel the remaining hereditary peers from the House of Lords. If the second chamber approves, the changes will be the biggest shake-up of Parliament in a quarter of a century. Our correspondent Sean Curran was watching as both MPs and peers debated the future of the upper house.
Motion for debate, House of Lords reform, the Lord Privy Seal.
A debate on the House of Lords is always guaranteed to pull in the crowds, in the second chamber at least. The red benches were full as peers considered a government motion that simply took note of House of Lords reform. But at the other end of the Palace of Westminster, there were plenty of empty seats.
The clerk will now proceed to read the orders of the day.
House of Lords Hereditary Peers Bill, Committee.
A handful of dedicated MPs settled in for a long afternoon as they argued over amendments to the bill. A Cabinet Office Minister, Ellie Reeves, thought there was no real objection to the main aim of the legislation.
This bill is a matter of principle. In the 21st century, it cannot be right for there to be places in our legislature reserved for those born into certain families.
Back in the 1990s, when Tony Blair's government removed the right of most of the hereditary peers to sit in Parliament, 92 were allowed to stay on. There are by-elections to find replacements when peers die or retire. Those elections are on hold until January 2026, which means at the moment there are 88 hereditaries. Ellie Reeves was keen to stress that this latest change was strictly business.
The government values the good work done by hereditary peers, and we have spoken on several occasions about the individuals who have served in Parliament with duty and dedication. These reforms are not personal, but they are long overdue and essential.
For the Conservatives, Alex Burghardt dismissed the proposals as a nervous little bill.
What we see here today is really an attempt to gerrymander the membership of the House of Lords under cover of a reform. New Clause 20 in my name allows us to call the bill out for what it is. We would like the government's failure to bring forward a proper plan for House of Lords reform, as promised in their manifesto, recorded in black and white as part of this bill.
He was challenged by a fellow Conservative, the father of the House, Sir Edward Lee.
I'm a bit worried about what my honourable friend is saying. Why do we need a comprehensive plan at all? Well, just leave it alone.
Alex Burghardt insisted the Conservatives didn't seek comprehensive reform, but Labour had promised it. For the Liberal Democrats, Sarah Olney wanted to see broader and bolder changes, including directly elected members of the Lords.
Reform of our upper chamber has been a long-standing Liberal Democrat policy. We must do all we can to restore public trust in politics after the chaos of the previous Conservative government. By introducing a democratic mandate for members of the House of Lords, we can ensure that trust in politics is strengthened.
The Conservative former Cabinet Minister Sir Gavin Williamson proposed removing the 26 Church of England archbishops and bishops, who are known as the Lords Spiritual.
There is only one other sovereign country that has clerics within their parliamentary body, and that is Iran. I do not think that is necessarily the best model for us to base ourselves on. This piece of legislation gives us the opportunity to be able to have a more reflective parliamentary body.
Over in the Lords, Labour's Lord Grocott has long campaigned to abolish hereditary peers and those by-elections.
The zenith of absurdity was reached in 2016 when, for a new Liberal Democrat peer, there were seven candidates and an electorate of three. More than twice as many candidates as electors. The winning candidate got all three votes, the remaining six got none. As they say, you couldn't make it up.
Critics of the Lords are always keen to point out that only China's National People's Congress has more members. A Conservative hereditary, Lord Mancroft, argued that the government's proposals would give the Prime Minister control of the second chamber.
What the government is proposing is to give the Prime Minister the same powers of appointment that President Xi has. The silly joke, my Lord, is about to become reality. With the bill the government is now proposing, this House and this Parliament will be on the way to becoming like the toothless farce that is the Chinese People's Congress.
Peers will return to the subject. Last night, the government saw off attempts to change the bill and it cleared the Commons. The next stage of the process is for the Lords to debate and vote on the plans.
Sean Curran there, and you can hear more on events yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on digital radio.
Time now is 10 to 7. Nigel Railton, the new chairman of the Post Office, has undertaken a strategic review and will outline a five-year plan for the Post Office in a meeting with staff and sub-postmasters at 9 a.m. It's going to include significant cuts at head office, with hundreds of roles expected to go, and the 115 remaining Crown offices at risk of closure. They're directly managed by the Post Office with more than 1,200 staff. The sites are loss-making, and the Post Office is trying to secure new franchise partners for them. I'll just read you the Post Office statement before we speak to the Communication Workers Union. They say, the Post Office, today we will set out a new deal for postmasters and the future of the Post Office as an organisation. It will dramatically increase postmasters' share of revenues, strengthen our branch network and make it work better for local communities, independent postmasters and our partners who own and operate branches. Let's speak to Andy Fury, National Officer for Post Offices at the CWU, Communication Workers Union. Andy, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us. What are your members most concerned about with this 9 o'clock meeting?
Well, when the news broke last night, the social media feeds went crazy with people distressed, very angry, upset, and feeling totally let down by the Post Office. Our members have given many, many years of loyal public service to their communities. They joined the Post Office for a career. They've been there for most of their working lives, the vast majority of them, and now it would appear they're being thrown on the scrap heap because of the complete mismanagement of the Post Office for many, many years.
And do you think they're being tarred with the sort of guilt by association with that Horizon IT scandal?
Absolutely. I mean, our people feel that they are associated victims of the Horizon scandal, clearly not in the same league as people being wrongly imprisoned and losing their homes and their businesses. But our members have worked for the company for many, many years. They exist to serve the public in their local communities. They're well respected. They do a fabulous job. And now, because you know, succession of management have run the company into the ground and have been able to find as much money as they want for the futile legal defences of the indefensible. They got money when it suits them, and now they haven't. But what I don't agree with is that the directly managed are losing, you know, is a massively loss-making network. There is far too many managers in the company, and it's a bloated managerial structure, and that's quite rightly where the job cuts should come. But that Nigel Railton needs to sit down and work with the union to find a way forward. Your closure of the Crown network is not the way forward.
Sorry to interrupt there, Andy. Final thought from you. I mean, is your assessment that the business model of the post office with these independent franchises is bust? And if it is bust, what do you think needs to be done to fix it?
Well, first and foremost, the postmasters do need a much better deal. They're on an absolute pittance, and they've been used and abused by the post office for many, many years. And indeed, Paula Venables, the former CEO, took money away from them in their remuneration packet. So the model is broke. The postmasters need a better deal, but it's going to have to need government subsidy for yet many years to come, unfortunately. And we're meeting with Gareth Thomas, the minister, on Monday, and we will be stressing there needs to be investment, there needs to be support, there needs to be a growth agenda, because we've got to preserve the great post office for the public of the UK.
Andy Fury, National Officer for Post Offices at the CWU Communication Workers Union, thank you.
It's 6 minutes to seven. Children will only be allowed water or milk on their school drinks menu as part of a council-run Healthy Schools programme to tackle obesity. 30 primary schools across Knowsley are taking part, and the move comes after recent NHS data showed that the Merseyside borough had the highest proportion of obese and overweight 10 to 11-year-olds in England, and it wasn't a good picture in reception age either. Dr Sarah McNulty, Director of Public Health at Knowsley Council, joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma. Hi.
Hello. Drinking only water or milk. What were they drinking before at school?
Juice, things that were high in sugar. So, this isn't just about obesity, but also about kind of protecting children's teeth and oral health.
Why were juice and sugary drinks being given to children at school?
I guess, you know, we're all on a journey, aren't we, about what's good, what's not so good. And, you know, juice isn't bad on its own. It's just part of a package. So the package that we're offering with children is just about small incremental changes. You know, the school meals weren't terrible before, but actually we're just trying to just change things a little bit. You know, adding more vegetables to things, offering more fruit, things like that. So it's not about massive changes. It's just about little changes that we think will help.
The children have got to eat those things, of course, which can be a challenge at home as well as outside of the home. But I'm sure you've looked at how you can try and make this as successful as possible, or certainly what will represent success. What is that?
Yeah, I mean, like I say, this is about incremental change. It's also not just about the food that's on offer. So we're working with the schools to try and get children to be more active in school. I mean, you know, you may have heard about things like the Day of the Mile that have been around for a while. Active travel plans, trying to get children and families to walk more, to get on bikes, things like that. And also, as part of the general package of care that we offer. We also do provide things like cookery classes for families who may want to take up that offer, and they'll work with families to try and get them to again, make small incremental changes to their diets.
And then in terms of how long you need on this, or just potentially to see those figures change in some way, because they are quite astonishing figures.
They are quite astonishing figures, and this isn't the magic bullet. You know, this isn't the only thing that we need to change. You know, obesity is really complex, and we know that in Knowsley, it's particularly an issue. We've got a lot of low income families here. We know the cost of living is a huge barrier. We also know though that our parents and families do want to eat healthier, but they really do see things like cost as a barrier. So the things that we can control, the things that children can be offered in school, I think will really, really help. And also it's about kind of exposing children to different tastes as their taste buds are developing. So hopefully that will make things easier as they when they go home and they're offered different things as well.
Dr Sarah McNulty, Director of Public Health at Knowsley Council. Thank you.
It's 3 minutes to seven.
On BBC iPlayer.
Of all the wonderful places in the world, one continent holds more riches than any other. Asia has the world's highest mountains, the hottest place on the Earth's surface, the richest concentration of marine life, a trillion trees. and more people than in the rest of the world combined.
Asia with David Attenborough.
There's nowhere else on Earth with so many untold stories.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
It's 2 minutes to seven. Let's get the latest on the weather from Stav Donaires. Hi, Stav.
Hi there, Emma and Amal. Thank you very much. Good morning to you. Well, the weather is remaining quiet for the next few days, thanks to high pressure. But that high pressure will start to retreat as we move into the weekend. Low pressure takes over. It will become quite unsettled with wet and increasingly windy weather developing, particularly on Sunday. And as that pulls away, we'll open the floodgates to a cold northerly Arctic airflow. So next week looks a lot colder for us all, both by day and by night, with some frost at night and a chance of sleet and snow in places, mainly over hills in the north. Today it's a chilly start for all, and we've got some issues with dense mist and fog patches around. These will tend to lift and clear slowly through the morning, but some areas may stay rather grey. Scotland and Northern Ireland will stay mostly cloudy today compared to yesterday. The best of any sunshine will be across eastern Scotland, but western Scotland and Northern Ireland will see that mist and fog lifting into low cloud, and some of the cloud thick enough for some patchy light rain, especially across Argyll and the Highlands. As we head into England and Wales, well, here it's also cloudy for many compared to yesterday. Some mist and fog, particularly northwest England into Wales, the West Midlands. These will tend to lift through the morning, although a few places may stay rather grey and cloudy all day. But much of the south and east of England will see the sunny spells. Lighter winds in the southeast, fewer showers, and temperatures will range from around 11 to 14 Celsius, pretty much where we should be for the time of year. The next 2 days look rather cloudy, limited sunshine, then it turns more unsettled into the weekend.
Stav, thank you very much. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amal Rajan. It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday the 13th of November. The headlines. The Church of England is facing calls for more resignations after Justin Welby stood down as the Archbishop of Canterbury over the handling of a child abuse scandal. We'll speak to Stephen Cottrell, the Archbishop of York, before 8 o'clock. The NHS in England has been told there will be no more rewards for failure, as the government warns it will sack senior managers who don't improve patient care. Health Secretary Wes Streeting joins us at 8:10. And the world's richest man, Elon Musk, and a Fox News anchor have been offered jobs in Donald Trump's new administration.
Also in this hour, I've been talking to the new head of British Vogue, Cho Minardi, on the worrying return of very thin models in fashion.
I do think perhaps Ozempic has something to do with it. We're in this moment where we're seeing the sort of pendulums swing back to skinny being in, and often these things are treated like a trend, and we don't want them to be.
That's Cho Minardi talking. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
Some survivors of abuse at the hands of John Smythe have called for senior clergy in the Church of England who knew about his behaviour to join the Archbishop of Canterbury in standing down. Justin Welby resigned yesterday after being criticised for failing to ensure allegations against Smythe were thoroughly investigated. One vicar has predicted Archbishop Welby's departure could be the beginning of what he called a clear-out. Here's our religion editor, Ali McBull.
Already, survivors of John Smythe's abuse, who did feel Justin Welby should step down for not doing enough and not earlier acknowledging what they'd been through, are asking questions about other clergy implicated. Four sitting bishops were named in the review of the church's handling of the case as knowing about the abuse long before it was made public and before it came to an end. Among them, the Bishop of Lincoln, Stephen Conway, has issued an apology for not taking further action, but later said that action should mainly have been to push for the office of Archbishop Welby to do more. Some survivors have asked for more resignations, and not just for the poor handling of John Smythe, but the cases of other abusers as well.
The Bishop of Winchester, Philip Mountstephen, was asked on BBC Newsnight whether other bishops who were accused of failing to act in the case of Smythe should also resign.
Safeguarding is everybody's business. Yes, it's the bishop's business.
Did they fail,
but it's,
those
it's
bishops,
everyone
then?
Else's business. And I would just stress again that we need a consistent, appropriate, proportionate response to safeguarding failings, whether that's on the part of bishops or whether that's on the part of everyone else. If simply we say, well, this is just a problem of bishops, we'll just deal with the bishops, we will leave to one side all sorts of other failings that may have happened elsewhere.
League tables are to be introduced for hospitals in England. Managers who persistently fail to improve performance won't get pay rises or will be replaced. The Health Secretary Wes Streeting says his plans mean there will be no more turning a blind eye to failure. Two NHS organisations have expressed concern about the approach. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
In his first set-piece speech on NHS reform, Mr Streeting will say he aims to ensure every penny of extra investment in England's health service will be well spent and will cut patient waiting times. Senior health managers who don't meet targets and improve patient care will be denied wage increases. The best-performing trusts will be given more funding for buildings and equipment and control over how to use it. Failing organisations will be scrutinised and managers may be replaced. Hospital league tables will be published based on a range of performance indicators, which have yet to be fully spelt out. Trusts will be barred from hiring agency staff in some roles, including junior healthcare assistants. Mr Streeting will speak at a conference run by NHS providers, representing trusts, which has warned that league tables could bring unintended consequences. Another employers group, the NHS Confederation, said staff should not be made to feel they were being named and shamed.
Donald Trump has nominated a presenter on the television channel Fox News to serve as the US Defense Secretary in his new administration. He's also confirmed that the tech billionaire Elon Musk will have an advisory role on cutting red tape and government spending. Mr. Musk will work alongside the businessman Vivek Ramaswamy, one of Donald Trump's former rivals for the Republican presidential nomination. Our North America editor Sarah Smith reports from Washington.
Donald Trump is making clear he intends to entirely reshape the American government by appointing Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy to drastically reduce government spending, slash regulation, and dismantle government bureaucracy. Mr. Trump has described the new Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, as the New Manhattan Project. That was the US program to develop nuclear weapons in the 1940s. That's an indication of how dramatic he hopes the impact of their work will be. Mr. Trump has also named Peter Hegseth as Defense Secretary. He's an Army combat veteran who spent the past 8 years working as a presenter on Fox News. He has no experience in government, and Mr. Hegseth may run into opposition from senior military leaders and might struggle to have his appointment confirmed in the Senate. But the president-elect is demanding the next Republican Senate leader should call recesses during which he can sidestep the usual confirmation process for his candidates.
The US State Department says it's confirmed that North Korean troops have begun fighting alongside Russian troops against Ukrainian forces. It says they are engaging in combat operations in the Kursk region of Russia, where Ukraine captured territory earlier this year. United Nations observers have accused Israel of severe violations of the demilitarized buffer zone with Syria. A UN force is present there as part of a ceasefire agreed between the two countries in 1974. It says it's made frequent complaints about Israeli construction work. Israel says it's strengthening defenses on its territory. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has been to the occupied Golan Heights and sent this report.
Satellite footage shows new trenches and earthworks appearing along large stretches of the frontier over the past few months. Most of it appears to lie outside the buffer zone, but the UN says some of the trenches have crossed into the demilitarized area and that Israeli forces have too, describing these as severe violations with the potential to increase tensions. The UN says it has repeatedly protested to the Israeli military. But Israel's army spokesman, Nadav Shoshani, told the BBC that the trenches were to protect against infiltration by Iran-backed groups in Syria and did not break the ceasefire agreement.
I can tell you that Israeli officials have been communicating with the UN, talking about these issues, and I can tell you IDF is operating on Israeli territory, making sure that a terror invasion is not possible, making sure we are defending our borders.
Israeli ground troops are already fighting Iranian allies on two other borders. But more than a year into this regional conflict, friction is also being felt along its quietest frontier.
BBC News understands hundreds of jobs could be cut at the headquarters of the post office as part of a plan to place sub-postmasters at the centre of the business. The shake-up is expected to be announced this morning. Our business correspondent Emma Simpson has more.
The post office is in crisis, dealing with the fallout from the Horizon IT scandal. But it needs to look at the future too. Its new chairman, Nigel Railton, will outline his five-year plan in a meeting with staff and sub-postmasters at 9 o'clock. He's already told the Post Office Inquiry that a new deal was needed for the self-employed sub-postmasters to put them at the centre of the business and dramatically increase their share of the revenues. This will mean big cuts at head office, with hundreds of roles expected to go, and the 115 remaining Crown offices are understood to be at risk of closure. They are directly managed by the Post Office, with more than 1,200 staff. These sites are loss-making, and it's understood the Post Office is looking at trying to secure new franchise partners to take them on instead.
Senior executives at social media companies could face fines if they fail to stop illegal knives being advertised on their platforms. The government wants to bring in the measure to help meet its target for halving knife crime over the next decade. And the judges of the Booker Prize have described this year's winning novel Orbital as a book about a wounded world. It was written by the British author Samantha Harvey and follows fictional astronauts on the International Space Station. She says the novel is a kind of nature writing about the beauty of space. Our culture editor Katie Razzle was at last night's awards ceremony in London.
The winner of the Booker Prize 2024 is Samantha Harvey.
It's 5 years since a woman last won the Booker Prize, and Samantha Harvey was the only British writer on the shortlist. Set over just 24 hours, her novel Orbital takes us into the lives of six astronauts in orbit as they experience the wonder of Earth from space. A few minutes after her win, I asked Samantha Harvey what it was like to hear her name announced for the £50,000 prize.
Complete overwhelm, shock. I felt and still do feel that I'm in a dream. I'm not at all convinced this is happening.
The judges praised the novel's ambition, and although it was the second shortest book ever to win, said it repays slow reading.
That was our culture editor, Katie Razzle.
Thanks very much, Alan, and we're looking forward to hearing from her just after 8 o'clock. So do stay with us for that and get a sense of what it was like to write that novel during successive lockdowns. But at 7:10, let's look at the story engulfing the Church of England, because as he became the first Archbishop of Canterbury in modern times to be forced to resign, Justin Welby spoke of his long-felt and profound sense of shame at the Church of England's historic failure to protect people from abuse. But it was his own handling of the church's worst child abuse scandal which was ultimately found wanting. Welby and others at the most senior ranks of the church, an institution now in crisis, were found by an independent review to have been insufficiently curious when the alarm was raised over a man called John Smythe, who physically, sexually and psychologically abused more than 100 boys and young men in Christian summer camps he helped run and with pupils at Winchester College. John Smythe continued abusing boys after 2013, when it was brought to Justin Welby's attention when living in Southern Africa, until his death in Cape Town in 2018, and he never faced justice. David Coltart, the mayor of Bulawayo in Zimbabwe, was the lawyer who represented the churches and victims of John Smythe's abuse there in the early 90s. He told us about the impact of the Church of England's institutional failure to tackle Smythe properly.
In allowing someone like Mr. Smythe to come out to Zimbabwe without giving what I would term an institutional warning to the church and church-related organizations in Zimbabwe, gave Mr. Smythe the cover to come out to Zimbabwe and start this Christian ministry and continue his abuse of young men.
Listening to that, an extraordinary statement. Julie Connolly, Bishop of Birkenhead and Deputy Lead Bishop for Safeguarding. It's just awful, isn't it, Julie?
It is awful, yes. I don't think I've got another word for it, really. I mean, we've tried many.
Why should people trust the church as a safe institution for children and vulnerable people?
It's frustrating for me because in many ways we've been working really hard at making churches safer places. No institution, nothing can ever be totally safe. But there's been loads of really good work going on. And what frustrates me is that we still have this institutional problem where we are not putting victims and survivors at the center. And so in some ways, we are not a safe institution. And that is so frustrating to those volunteers who work as parish safeguarding officers, for those people in parishes and chaplaincies who are doing all that they can make their activity safe.
And I think that's really important to say and talk about those people. But just hearing you say the Church of England is not a safe institution, when its entire being is meant to be about goodness, forgiveness, protection, love. I mean, should more heads roll? Do you want to see more senior clergy resign today?
What I'm really clear on is that just the Archbishop of Canterbury resigning is not going to solve the problem. I think he's done the right thing. I said on Friday when I spoke on the radio that words were not enough, and they're not. But this is about institutional change. This is about our culture. This is about a systemic failure. So there must be more that we need to do. And we know that the National Safeguarding Team, our safeguarding professionals, will go through the report looking for whether there's new information they need to act on.
But you've got a lot of the information, haven't you? Because the move to independent safeguarding has been recommended already by Alexis Jay. She was on the radio with my colleagues at World at One yesterday. She says bishops have been dragging their feet. Don't you think more people should resign who are dragging their feet, at least, or at least the bishops who've even been named in this independent report that left Justin Welby's position wanting?
And I think very possibly some other people should go. I mean, I'm not here to name names. I don't think I know the answer to that. I think what I'm saying is this is not just all about the Archbishop of Canterbury.
No, it's not.
The work begins and continues from this point.
But why?
So there may well be other people who should resign.
Sorry, I just wanted to get, there may be other people who are going to resign, but why are they dragging their feet? What's your understanding of that as Deputy Lead Bishop for Safeguarding?
I think this goes back to our cultural failing. If you're not putting victims and survivors front and centre, then you're focused on other things. You're focused on the protection of the institution. You're focused on your protection of yourself. You're focused on what you see as the mission of the church, failing to see that care for victims and survivors, protection of the most vulnerable, is absolutely at the centre of the mission of the church.
But why are people being abused in the church in the first place?
People are abused because people do evil, and that happens not just in the church but elsewhere. Part of the reason there are so many abuse scandals in the church is that we were not good enough. We did not move as quickly as other institutions in terms of what was then called child protection.
So just to understand that, I mean, can you say still to this day, as we're talking, even with the resignation yesterday of the Archbishop, which, as you say, is not going to clear this up, you can't guarantee that there isn't child abuse going on in the church right now, can you?
No, of course I can't, but nobody can in any institution. But I cannot guarantee that, and I wouldn't claim to at any point.
And
I do genuinely believe that our individual churches, our individual activities that we run are safer than they were before. But that isn't the problem we're looking at here. What we're particularly looking at is this cultural failure that we still have, an arrogance that we still have, I think, within the church, where we don't see what we should be seeing, and we don't act with the energy, as the Archbishop called it, it wasn't energetic enough. We don't put this first on the agenda. We don't prioritise it as much as we should.
What is the mood like in the Church of England today?
Mixed, I think, in fairness. I think everybody I've spoken to is absolutely furious about what Makin has set out for us. But I think people are also sad that Archbishop Justin is going in this way, and grateful that he has resigned over this, because it is so important.
Well, we'll talk to the Archbishop of York around 10 to 8. Julie Connolly, Bishop of Birkenhead. Thank you.
16 minutes past seven, let's move on to the NHS, because NHS investment must be matched with reform. That has long been the message from Whitehall, actually from across the political divide. And in the budget, the NHS got an extra £22.6 billion. So now comes the reform bit. In a speech in Liverpool today, Wes Streeting, the Health and Social Care Secretary, who's joining us at 10 past eight, will announce performance league tables for all NHS services. So managers will be sacked or denied pay rises if they fail to improve waiting times or stick to their budgets. Turnaround teams will be sent in if necessary, and those NHS trusts that perform well will be rewarded financially. League tables like this were introduced in 2001 by New Labour and then ditched in 2005 by New Labour. Dr. Adrian Boyle, is the president of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine and joins us now. Dr. Boyle, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you make of these reforms?
Well, it's good to try and do something different, and we need to see the detail that we see in the speech later on. The league tables is an interesting idea. Measuring good and bad performance is actually surprisingly complicated, especially since we've merged so many hospitals. So back in 2001, each individual hospital had its own performance, and that could be publicly reported. We're now in a very different situation where lots and lots of hospitals have been merged into what we call multi-site trusts. And this makes it really complicated to try and decide who's performing. So, for example, you might have a trust which runs three emergency departments, one with long waits, one with short waits, and one with waits that are in the middle. So trying to understand what is good and bad performance is actually surprisingly complicated.
Yeah, when you said league tables are an interesting idea, I did wonder if interesting was a euphemism there. I mean, are you concerned about what this will do for staff morale?
Yes, I'm also concerned that it will lead to short-term target chasing. And, you know, this government has, with the Darcy Review, has pointed out that we've got some really serious problems around with our estate, our capital planning, our IT, and we haven't seen any reform of the interface around social care and NHS work. And there's a real danger that if people just start focusing on the league tables, they won't put the effort into trying to sort out those really serious problems that we've got.
I hear what you say, but I mean, the government's saying, West Streeting, I'm sure, will say at 8:10 on this programme, that they've got separate plans to address those issues of capital, underinvestment, dodgy IT and so forth. And the thing I'd say to you, Dr. Boyle, is, isn't it true that there are, sadly, some, not all, but some mediocre managers in the NHS? And if there's been an overspend of £2 billion already in the first 3 months of this financial year, well, that can't be allowed to continue, can it? And it certainly wouldn't be tolerated in much of the private sector.
And I think it is absolutely right that people need to be made accountable for when things don't go well. You know, there's good and bad managers right across the NHS. And it is good to have some form of accountability, because accountability is something which I think everybody within the NHS struggles to try and measure. So I think they're right to try and do that. There's a difference between the intent and the way they do it. And going back, there is a risk that this will demoralise staff, and you will see that in poorly performing areas, recruitment and retention of staff, and that will go right down to clinical staff, will become even harder.
I'll put that very specific point to West Streeting in about an hour's time. In fact, in about 50 minutes' time. Dr. Adrian Boyle, thank you for joining us on what I know is a very busy day for you.
At 7:20, let's get a more insight from the business world, because the pub chain Fuller's has just reported a boost in sales in its latest financial results. Will Bain has more on that. Hello again, Will.
Hi, Emma. Yeah, that's right. Fuller's just published its results for the first half of the year, and revenue, pre-tax profit and sales all up on the previous year. The chief executive, Simon Emeny, is with us. Simon, morning.
Good morning, Will.
Looks like a pretty strong set of results then. Like-for-like sales in particular jump out as being quite a bit higher than a year before. What was driving that?
Yeah, it's been the culmination, really, of 3 years of very hard work post-COVID. We've invested well in our pub estate. Sales are up, as you say, 5.2%. Have carried on well into the second half of the year, very much around the return to offices, the return of tourism, and very well-attended sporting events. So it's been a very good start to the year.
We heard earlier in the week from Hospitality UK about, you know, the pressures that the industry feels it's under, and yet your results kind of paint quite an upbeat picture about your investment prospects for next year, expansion, doing up some of your pubs, things like that.
Yeah, I think it's worth bearing in mind that we still haven't fully recovered profits post-COVID, and I think that's in common with most of the sector. And we feel confident for the outcome for this financial year, but actually the cost increases that were announced 2 weeks ago in the budget will impact significantly across the sector from April 2025. And that for us is going to be a fresh challenge that we will need to adjust our business model for, because it is going to put an extra £3.5 billion of costs into the hospitality sector.
And how will you do that?
Good question. We've had to digest this. It's an extra £8 million worth of costs for our business alone, which, if you consider the profitability of the business in the first 6 months of the year, will be a significant challenge for myself and CEOs elsewhere in retail and hospitality, which are generally big employers of relatively young people. So it doesn't feel like a budget for working people. It doesn't feel like a budget for growth. I think it will restrict investment.
What about the price of drinks?
Well, I think that pricing is going to have to go up across the sector come the turn of 2025. And there's no way that a sector like ours can carry this level of cost and just absorb its profit. So regrettably, the customer will see higher prices in retail and in hospitality, which will, of course, work against the government's desire to reduce inflation. It will lead to a spike in inflation, and it will affect volumes, I would have thought.
Simon Emeny, the Chief Executive of Fuller's, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It is now 23 minutes past seven. Russia is launching unprecedented drone attacks at Ukraine. In October, a record 2,000 were reportedly fired, with 145 on Sunday alone. That's the most in a single day since Moscow's full-scale reinvasion of Ukraine. And in Ukraine's Kyiv region, air defense units are being stretched by relentless Russian aerial assaults, which often have deadly consequences. From there, our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse has filed this report.
They're a constant presence, but at the moment, the sirens of Kyiv and cities across Ukraine, they're not stopping. They go off at any point, every day. Sometimes they are followed by the booms of the city's air defences and explosions, and sometimes they're not. And somewhere, someone feels their full impact.
Her room and her bed.
In Kyiv, Victoria and Volodymyr show us what's left of their high-rise flat.
We heard the sirens, and almost immediately after, there was an explosion.
Their 14-year-old daughter, Maria, had come home early and was lying in her bed.
A Shahed drone flew in through the window, right into her room. She had no chance to survive. She died immediately.
My goodness. And it's immediate. You walk through the front door and their flat is completely gutted. And we are looking through a huge hole in the wall at the skyline of Kyiv. Everything is completely exposed. And this really connects it. You see these drones, you hear the sirens, but this is what they caused.
Everything burned down. There's nothing even left in the memory of my child. Our life is divided into before and after.
You can see the television bracket has bent from the heat. You can see your wine, scorched set of headphones. It's really heartbreaking to see, because you can sort of see the moment and what's been taken. It's very difficult.
Maria didn't want to leave the country. She had faith in victory. So we're all here. But sadly, she is not anymore.
As Ukraine waits to see how Donald Trump will approach this war when he re-enters office, North Korea has joined Moscow's invasion, and Maria's father, Volodymyr, is just baffled as to how it all started.
What's the point of it? There are no benefits. People just get killed. Unfortunately, the end of this doesn't depend too much on Ukraine, I think. It depends on other countries that help us.
Of course, Russia's general aim is to terrorize civilians.
Mikhailo Shamanov is from Kyiv's military administration.
Every night it's a lottery. Where it hits, where it's shot down, where it falls, and what happens. We understand that people are exhausted. But we cannot give up because Kyiv or other cities are being bombarded.
And it's mobile air defence units like this one which keep those drones out, or try to.
This is machine gun.
We are south of Kyiv in the expansive countryside next to the forest, where we meet Vitaly. For him, it has been a busy time.
Half a year ago, it was roughly 50 drones in a month. Now, it's up to 100 drones a night.
And how able are you to stop them? Just how difficult a task is it?
The more missile danger there is, and the more targets we have, the more our guys' spirits are lifted. They're ready to stand to the last hour, or the last shahed. The Russians will never break us by the amount of drones they send.
And sure enough, our conversation is interrupted by the echo of the air raid siren. Across the tree lines there, these guys are clearly defiant. They are motivated to defend cities like Kyiv, but they're also keen to express optimism, despite all of the political tides surrounding Ukraine at the moment. And that's not easy with the pressure this country is under.
James Waterhouse reporting there for us from Kyiv and across Ukraine, as he has been since Vladimir Putin's re-invasion. And we'll have more on the latest in Ukraine at about 8:40. For now, here's Mike Williams with the sport.
Amal, thank you. An independent football regulator for the elite men's club game in England moves another step closer today when legislation that will establish the body begins its second reading in the House of Lords. Designed to make the game more financially sustainable, the strengthened Football Governance Bill will, amongst other measures, give the regulator new powers over the Premier League's multi-million pound parachute payments that are given to relegated clubs. Well, I've just been speaking to our sports editor, Dan Rowan, who told me just what's at stake today.
Well, this is the first chance, Mike, for MPs to debate the main principles of this revamped bill, which will define the powers of the new football regulator, force clubs to engage more with fans, and is intended to boost the game's financial sustainability. 40 peers are due to speak today in the Lords about it. The Premier League has expressed concern at the regulator having unprecedented and untested powers, as they put it, to intervene in the distribution of its revenues, and said it could have a negative impact on its competitiveness and investment. That's been dismissed by the English Football League, however, which is pleased that parachute payments, which it says distort competition, but which the Premier League say are needed to encourage investment, are now in the scope of the regulator, even if they won't be abolished, and that a state of the game review that the body will conduct into the financial health of the game could prove pivotal in breaking the years of deadlock between the two leagues over greater redistribution of the top flight's wealth through the rest of the football pyramid. Here's EFL chairman Rick Parry.
The regulator is going to come in and carry out the state of the game report, and it will be updated periodically every 5 years. As I said, we think that's a seminal piece of work. It's never been done before, never been done independently. It'll be a comprehensive market study, and we hope it's going to be very targeted at identifying problems. We hope it's going to be diagnostic rather than just descriptive, that it really is going to isolate and highlight the problems. From our point of view, logically, we think that should then form the basis of the solution for whatever the revenue sharing formula is going to be. You run the risk that the two leagues will diverge from it. Logically, we think we're likely to come up with something that's pretty close to it, because if we didn't, what's the regulator going to say? So you would hope that both parties would come close to it, but there's no guarantee of that. The whole purpose of the State of the Game review is to make sure the regulator can meet its statutory objectives, and its primary objective is sustainability. So if the State of the Game review said, here are the problems, these are the things that are preventing you from securing sustainability, it seems fairly clear to us that ought to be the solution. That's where we ought to be heading. And all being well, that's where the two leagues would head, because it'll give you a pretty clear understanding of this is what the regulator's looking for. But as we've seen, we're not very good at coming to deals.
That is the chair of the English Football League, Rick Parry. Dan Rowan's still with me. Dan, what else could be debated today?
Well, the Premier League will, I think, oppose any attempt by the regulator to dictate the level of parachute payments. So it may be that some peers reflect their concerns today. Fair Game, a group of 34 lower league clubs, have called for 19 amendments to this bill, including the scrapping of parachute payments, a veto on any financial redistribution deal, the exclusion of the possibility that the owner of a club could be a state or state-controlled entity. I think once the second reading's complete, the bill, of course, then proceeds to the committee stage, where any amendments to it may be debated and eventually voted on. So still lots to play for, Mike, ahead of what will be the biggest change to the way the game is run in decades.
Sports editor Dan Rowan, and we will get the perspective of the Premier League clubs on the Football Governance Bill in the next hour of the programme by speaking to Paul Barber, who is Chief Executive of Brighton and Hove Albion.
Mike, thanks very much. And here's Michael Burke to tell us about this evening's unmissable moral maze.
Morning, Emma. Morning, Amel. Jamie Oliver's latest book's been a recipe for disaster. It's a children's novel, or at least it was, featuring an Indigenous Australian girl with mystical powers. A campaign group have accused him of the trivialisation and stereotyping of First Nations people. He's mortified. The publishers have unpublished it. Nobody thinks the celebrity chef intended to offend. The only thing that seems to count is the supposed impact of his fantasy fiction on a vulnerable and historically abused group. Is that right? Does whether it's thoughtlessness or malice make a difference to the moral weight of an action? The law says yes, the grievance culture says no, the moral maze says, well, listen and find out after the news at 8 tonight.
Very much look forward to that. Thank you, Michael. The weather. Today, cloud will move in for much of Scotland, Northern Ireland and parts of Northern England and Northern Wales with patchy light rain towards the northwest.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. It's good to be with you. It's good to have your company. It's 27 minutes to 8. Let's now get a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Survivors of abuse at the hands of John Smythe have called for senior clergy in the Church of England who knew about his behaviour to stand down. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, resigned yesterday after being criticised for failing to ensure allegations against Smythe, a barrister associated with the church, were thoroughly investigated by the authorities. Julie Connolly, the Bishop of Birkenhead and Deputy Lead Bishop for Safeguarding, told this programme there may well be other people who need to resign. Excuse me. Plans to improve the NHS in England are to be set out by the Health Secretary Wes Streeting this morning. Underperforming senior managers will be replaced and hospital league tables are to be created. One organisation representing health employers has voiced concern about staff being named and shamed. The world's richest man, Elon Musk, is to help lead a new Department of Government Efficiency in the United States. Donald Trump has also nominated Pete Hegseth, a presenter on Fox News and a military veteran, as his defense secretary. The US State Department says it's confirmed that North Korean troops have begun engaging in combat operations alongside Russian forces close to the border with Ukraine. There's been no comment from Moscow or Pyongyang. United Nations observers have accused Israel of severe violations of the demilitarized buffer zone with Syria. A UN force says it has made frequent complaints about Israeli construction work there, and new trenches have breached the area several times in the past few months. That's disputed by Israel, which says these are defensive operations on Israeli territory. And an expert has shed light on the mystery surrounding a suspected Russian spy. A beluga whale named Hvaldimir was found in 2019 off the coast of a Norwegian island, wearing a harness inscribed with the words Equipment St. Petersburg. Now a scientist specialising in whales says it appears the animal escaped from a Russian naval base in the Arctic Circle.
Totally extraordinary story. We'll have more on that at 5 to 9. Alan, thank you. Well, as Alan also mentioned, we've been hearing overnight about how Donald Trump's new cabinet is taking shape. An informal but influential role for Elon Musk. Some very surprising announcements to top jobs. And above all, loyalty prized and rewarded. And a short time ago, I spoke to our North America editor, Sarah Smith, and I asked her what kind of administration Donald Trump is assembling.
One entirely in his own image, I would say. This tells us that this is Donald Trump's world now, and he is going to do exactly what he wants with it, no matter how radical or unorthodox. The key thing with all of the people he has appointed so far is that they are extremely loyal to him. That's their main, sometimes their only, qualification for the job. These are people he knows will be willing to enact his most far-reaching plans, and that is a complete change from his first administration, when he felt stymied and blocked by a lot of the people he was surrounding himself with. So some of these are some pretty unorthodox appointments, but he's doing this because he has got a grand vision for reshaping America, and he thinks that these are the people who will go on that journey with him.
Let's talk about DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. It's, I mean, sort of unforeseeable even a few years ago that you'd get a new department which was basically named after, is an in-joke in the world of cryptocurrency. Also unforeseeable that the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, would be the person appointed to run it. What is DOGE and what does it tell us about Donald Trump's America second time round?
Well, the first thing to know about the Department of Government Efficiency is that it is not a Department of Government. It couldn't be because Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, the biotech entrepreneur who's going to be running it alongside Elon Musk, couldn't divest themselves of all the financial interest they would have to in order to become federal employees. So it's an advisory commission, but one that's clearly going to have a lot of power and Donald Trump's say-so behind it. And we're not just talking about slashing some government spending here. They're talking about restructuring federal agencies, completely remaking the structure of government. So as well as taking out trillions of spending is what they want to do, they're going to reduce massively the size of government as well. That's what Elon Musk has talked about himself. And in announcing this, Donald Trump, he actually described it as the Manhattan Project of our time. Now, obviously, they are not going to be developing nuclear weapons. That's not their remit. But that is an idea of the scale of what he wants to do. He wants to leave America with a completely different kind and size of government than the one that he's inheriting at the moment. I mean, in some ways, some of this would be laughable, frankly, if it wasn't so serious. Elon Musk has already posted on X, formerly known as Twitter, that the public should let him know via X if they're cutting something important or not cutting something wasteful, and that he wants to have a leaderboard for the most insanely dumb spending of your tax dollars, which he thinks will be extremely tragic and extremely entertaining at the same time.
Extraordinary. And there are also some slightly more surprising or unforeseen appointments, including a defense secretary who's a army veteran and Fox News host, who is Pete Hegseth.
Well, he is exactly, as you say, a television presenter who has served in the army. He served in Afghanistan, in Iraq. He has absolutely no experience of government, a complete outsider from the Pentagon. He has written a book about the military, which Donald Trump seems to be particularly keen on. He wrote in all caps that it had spent 2 weeks at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. That's the sort of thing that impresses him. And that was all about getting rid of the woke generals who he thinks have destroyed the military. I mean, one of the controversial things about Peter Hegseth is that during Donald Trump's first term, he successfully lobbied him to get pardons for some troops who had been convicted of war crimes, but he thought were being treated unfairly. And his complete lack of experience has been met with consternation, in fact, I would say shock, from the defense community, who really didn't expect him, someone like him, to be appointed. I mean, his main qualification seems to be that in his 8 years on TV, he has staunchly defended Donald Trump's policies and agrees with him on quite a lot of military matters. And I mean, this will sound incredibly trivial, but I'm afraid to Donald Trump it matters. He looks the part. He's very tall, handsome, square-jawed, looks like a movie matinee military officer. And that is the sort of thing that Donald Trump likes.
Sarah Smith. And I also spoke to Ross Gerber. He's CEO and president of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment. And interestingly, he's an investor in Tesla. And he gave his reaction.
Well, I think that the post-Trump, you know, rally is a short-term move in markets trying to, you know, reallocate to a new reality that many didn't expect. But it doesn't change Tesla's reality in the different challenges that they face. So over time, stock prices will move to where the value really is in a company. So I think that on the short term, this is nice, but I think until it actually proves to help Tesla over a long-term period, they have to overcome the issues they face no matter what.
And in a broader sense, how do you think most Americans ought to think about this budding bromance between Donald Trump and Elon Musk, both in terms of their relationship and the task that they have set themselves, which is to somehow get a grip on America's, you know, $6 trillion plus of spending, and particularly spending on debt interest?
Well, certainly they're not going to be able to do anything about the spending on the debt, but they certainly can address spending in America because the waste is enormous, and anybody could actually do this job pretty well because it's so obvious. But I think, you know, once again, having really smart people put their mind to task on solving government issues is not a bad thing for the U.S. government. Certainly, it's not being done today. So I have no negative thought to them attempting to deal with this bureaucracy. That said, I'm an investor, and so for me, it doesn't per se benefit me. I highly recommend including myself, staying out of politics as a CEO because it's become so divisive.
It is an extraordinary thing, isn't it, that Elon Musk, once a Trump-criticizing Democrat supporter, I mean, he's been on one hell of a journey when it comes to his politics, hasn't he?
Yeah, in fact, it was only a decade ago we were quite close with our political belief systems. And if you would have told me a decade ago that this would be the path of Elon Musk, I would have laughed and said zero chance. So, you know, this story is only half over with Elon, and I can't tell you where the other half leads.
Ross Gerber, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
18 minutes to 8. Are the moves towards body positivity, representing and celebrating bodies of all shapes and sizes, going backwards in the fashion industry more generally? That is the worry of the head of British Vogue, Cho Minardi. I've been speaking to her ahead of a new installation that's opening, telling the story of the fashion runway and some of the most iconic shows. A conversation you'll hear just after 8:30, in which she also has some advice about the art of getting dressed. You may not feel that that is an art, but perhaps you will be inspired. But she did talk to me about the body size trend going in the wrong direction and the rise, yet again, of fashion houses using very thin models. And I asked how concerned she is about so-called skinny being back.
We should be all concerned. I am very concerned, and I know many of my colleagues are very concerned. And I do think perhaps Ozempic has something to do with it. We're in this moment where we're seeing the sort of pendulums swing back to skinny being in, and often these things are treated like a trend, and we don't want them to be.
Why do you think that's happening?
I don't think we can pin it on any one thing. I do think that Ozempic has something to do with it, because we're seeing a lot of celebrities who are
using it,
and I think there's this shift in the culture around how we think about our bodies and how we address our bodies.
Are you thinking of trying to do anything to address Ozempic?
I think it's important that all bodies are represented, but I think it's not something that we as a magazine can change on our own, because obviously the designers are making clothes at a sample size, and often it takes more
a sample size, just to be clear, is what in UK terms?
It's a six or a four, I would say.
Gosh.
I mean, it ranges, I think, depending on the designer, depending on the brand, but it's roughly around that size, or an eight. I mean, I would say it was like a four to an eight. It's something that we need to, that is really worth talking about in fashion right now, because it is a real problem.
I suppose, have you noticed a change from brands as well?
I felt that this past season there was a lot of backsliding. There were certain brands who did really well and included non-sample size models, and there were certain models who have been on the cover of Vogue, like Paloma Elsesser and Precious Lee. But I didn't think there was enough representation as far as body diversity, and it felt almost like at certain shows the girls were especially thin, or the women, the models, were especially thin.
It must be strange to see that going in that direction.
It is. It's hopefully it's not something that will endure, and it's something that will, you know, hopefully this season will be a wake-up call, and it won't be that we see that progress, that kind of negative trend.
Cho Minardi talking there, the head of British Vogue. You'll hear more from her in the next hour.
Well, after the resignation of the Archbishop of Canterbury yesterday, we're joined this morning for Thought for the Day in the studio by the Reverend Dr. Rob Marshall, Rector of Digswell, Welwyn Garden City. Good morning, Reverend.
Good morning, Emma. Good morning, Emma. The Archbishop of Canterbury then yesterday acknowledged that the Makin report into the prolific child abuser John Smythe had exposed the long-maintained conspiracy of silence about the heinous abuses which went unpunished before Smythe's death in 2018. Now, given what has emerged in recent days, there was simply no alternative but for Justin Welby to go. He's now taken personal and institutional responsibility for the long and traumatising period between 2013 and 2024, when it's obvious more should have been done to seek appropriate justice. So the main focus of my thoughts this morning is very clearly on the victims of the horrific brutality which they endured, not only at the time of the abuse, but ever since. Andrew Greystone, who's a campaigner for the survivors, says they tell him that the way they have been treated by the church is nearly as bad as the way they were treated by their abuser. Lessons must be learned beyond the resignation of one church leader. Of course, we all have a clear responsibility to safeguard children and vulnerable adults in all areas of life. But human nature being what it is, in a lot of institutions, it takes immense courage to speak out, to act, to do what's right, even if it means upsetting the apple cart so that justice is done. Now, at a parish level in the Church of England, there have been huge strides forward in recent years in creating safe spaces for everyone. And this reflects Jesus' call in the Gospel for the protection of the vulnerable when he says absolutely, unequivocally, if anyone causes one of these little ones to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and be drowned in the depths of the ocean. But today is about hearing the voices of those affected by the failings of the National Church and others to act at the right time. And as a member of the Church of England, as a priest within it, I believe that we now do need a time of serious reflection, repentance and soul-searching. Andy Morse, who's a victim of Smythe's abuse, said this week that there isn't a day or two goes by without me thinking about it. And Mark Stibbs, who's a former priest and now an author, said that after lots of support over the years from various quarters, we are still, and I quote, suffering broken hearts, broken marriages and broken lives as a result of it, so it never really goes away. Now that the conspiracy of silence has been broken with the publication of the Makin Report, today is not about a resignation at all, really, but about a pledge to act and to do everything we can to listen and also to hear. We can never be said in any organisation to have been too busy, too loyal, too trusting to listen. We need always to respond appropriately to all children and vulnerable people.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dr. Rob Marshall. Very possibly, some other people should go. That was the verdict of the Bishop of Birkenhead, the Church of England's Deputy Head of Safeguarding, to us half an hour ago as I asked whether more bishops should resign over the handling of the worst abuse scandal in the Church's history. Julie Connolly spoke of an arrogance that we still have within the Church, where we don't see what we should be seeing. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, resigned yesterday, saying he must take personal and institutional responsibility. The Archbishop was found by an independent review to have been insufficiently curious when the alarm was raised over a man called John Smythe, who you've just been hearing about, who physically, sexually and psychologically abused more than 100 boys and young men at Christian summer camps he helped run and pupils he met at Winchester College. He never faced justice. What more is needed now from the Church of England? I'm joined by the other Archbishop, Stephen Cottrell, Archbishop of York. Good morning.
Good morning.
It absolutely stinks, doesn't it?
Yes. Listening just now to the Thought for the Day, I agree with the priest who said we must now be a renewed pledge to act. I read the Makin Review last week with shock and horror and deep sadness. And first of all, and every time we speak about this, our first thoughts must be to the victims and survivors of this awful abuse. But we also know that some people pretty systematically covered this up, and that those people do need to be brought to account.
Well, it sounds like that you don't think they have. So just to stay, well, first of all, with the Archbishop of Canterbury, with your relationship with him, which I imagine is pretty close, that the review says he wasn't sufficiently curious. What are your personal thoughts about why he was not?
Well, first of all, I admire the decision that he's made to take personal responsibility for institutional failings. And yes, of course, there were and are criticisms of him in it. The Makin Review, if you look at the, you know, I have obviously read the Makin Review, a sobering, horrifying read. But the Makin Review says on the front, lessons learned. And that's the spirit of this report, to hold a mirror up to the Church, to say there are things that we must do differently. There is culture change.
But why do you think the Archbishop wasn't sufficiently curious? Why?
Well, I believe Archbishop Justin, you know, this is the paradox of this. There have been great steps taken in the safeguarding of the Church under his watch, but on this case, Perhaps he relied too much on others. I simply don't know. But I think what I'm trying to focus on now is what we need to do to make the church a safer place.
Do you need to fire other people? Should there be more resignations? Because if you just look at this now, he was not the only leader, as you say, directly criticised. You are now, in effect, the most powerful man in the church. What are you going to do about the Bishop of Lincoln, Stephen Conway, who was also informed of Smythe's abuse in 2013 at the same time as the Archbishop?
Well, as I say, the review speaks about lessons learned, and as it happens, if when people read the review, they will see that the Bishop of Lincoln, then the Bishop of Ely, was actually the first person to do something about this. He informed the police, he informed South Africa, he informed Lambeth, seeing straight away this was an Anglican communion issue.
But he didn't stick with it, did he? He said in a statement, I'm clear I did all within my authority as a Bishop of Church of England, bearing in mind I had no authority over an entirely independent province, now talking about on another continent, with his move, Smythe's move to Southern Africa. But this wasn't kept with, and there was no justice faced. So we've just heard from another bishop that possibly other people should go. Can I ask you very clearly, should there be other resignations in the Church of England? People have been named.
Yeah, I said that at the beginning of the interview. Those who actively covered this up, which was not bishops. When people speak about the Church of England, we need to remember we're speaking about literally thousands of branches, parishes, chaplaincies in hospitals, schools, prisons.
So you don't think any bishops should go?
Well, the Archbishop of Canterbury has resigned.
So you know, that's enough, in your view?
This is not a small thing. Yes, because he's resigned for the institutional failures. The review is a lessons learned review, and I can say to you, there are lessons we need to learn.
But how can people have faith in that? And I use that word quite distinctly here, because we heard yesterday, you've been told as an institution by Alexis Jay, she spoke to my colleagues on the World at One programme yesterday, that you've been told to move to independent safeguarding, and bishops are dragging their feet. So you're sitting here saying that the top bishop's gone, so no other bishops need to go, despite what some of the survivors feel. And then you're saying lessons have been learned. Well, how can anybody have any faith?
No, but you're saying this is where we are. Just to be clear.
Let me ask the question.
Just to be clear, you're putting words into my mouth. I didn't say lessons had been learned. I said that is what the Making Review is. And now we need to learn the lessons. And by the way, it was me and Archbishop Justin who commissioned the Jay report. We are acting on it.
Yeah, but why are you, why is she saying, let me use her words, the author, why is she saying you are dragging your feet about independent safeguarding?
I believe that we are moving we have a synodical process. The Church of England, I am not, nor was Justin Welby, by the way, the CEO of an organisation who is able to make those changes on their own. So we are doing what has to be done through our synodical processes, which actually has to go through some of these changes. I'm not sure whether these ones do, but many of our changes need to go through Parliament itself. So, yes, I'm frustrated, like Professor Jay, that takes time, but those things are happening. But even as I say
how long is it going to take? How long is it going to take to have independent safeguarding? Could you put a figure on it for survivors?
I believe that on the current plan, that the response to JET, the response group to the Jay recommendations, will come to the General Synod in 2025. But
when will the changes happen?
Well, that will bring about the changes.
That does bring about the change. Sorry, I was just trying to understand for those not familiar with synodical process.
Yeah, it is not for any one archbishop to be able to make this change on their own. But I don't want to sound complacent here. I am horrified by what I read in the Making Review. I now find I have additional responsibilities to change the culture and to change the way the church is safeguarded. But we must understand that the church is a very, very large organisation and a very dispersed organisation. We're a place where literally thousands and thousands of people, anyone is able to be part of our church.
Archbishop,
so safeguarding such an organisation is a challenge.
It's a challenge, but
it's a challenge
but
we're determined to meet.
You've got to move fast, haven't you? And not least when the first Archbishop in modern times to resign, certainly in this position and like this, has had to do so. He's felt he's had to do so. He's used the word shame. Can I just ask you, Archbishop, is child abuse still going on in the church?
Sadly, there is abuse in our world and in our society, and therefore there is always the possibility that that will happen in the church. So
can't rule it out that right now children and vulnerable people could be being abused in the church, and you cannot bring the process any faster than next year to make the change that the church doesn't mark its own homework and not be the ones to safeguard children after we've just seen an archbishop resign.
That they are two questions. Yes, I can give a guarantee that the safeguarding structures and policies and training, every parish has a safeguarding officer, that is in place right now. The question of independence is about the independent scrutiny of that, and to ensure professional standards for safeguarding are the same across, they are Professor Jay's recommendations.
I've got very little time. Can I just ask, do you think there should still be bishops in the House of Lords? There's changes potentially happening there. Do you see why people feel uncomfortable with you having a right to scrutinise legislation?
That is an issue for the government and the nation.
What's your opinion, though, in light of this?
My opinion is that whilst I have the privilege of serving in the House of Lords, I will use that position for the public good. But it's not up to me to decide.
It's not up to you. I just
wanted
your opinion, Archbishop, which I tried to get.
Which I've just given. So
that you feel it's right to be in that place. And
but
use
today's
it.
Today's not a day for that. If I was a victim and survivor listening to this, I don't want to talk about the House of Lords.
No, but they might want to know they might want to know about those who have scrutiny of the laws that control those in our community and the police, for instance. Archbishop of York, Stephen Cottrell, thank you.
It's 2 minutes to eight. Let's get the latest on the weather from Stav Danaos.
Thanks very much, Amal and Emma. Good morning to you. The weather is remaining quiet for the next few days, thanks to high pressure, which will be sticking close by just to the west of the UK. Now, as we head into the weekend, though, high pressure will slip away and allow low pressure to develop across the country, and that's going to bring more unsettled condition. We will see some rain at times, something we haven't seen for a while, and it will be turning increasingly windy, particularly on Sunday. And then into next week, as that low pulls away, it'll open the floodgates to a cold and arctic northerly. So we're expecting much colder weather for many next week, perhaps with some sleet and snow in places, mainly on the hills in the north, and nights will turn very cold too. Back to the here and now, though, it is a lot quieter and it's not as cold. A chilly start to the day, and we've had some areas of dense mist and fog slowly clearing this morning, but they will be stubborn in a few places. So Scotland, Northern Ireland, mostly cloudy day for you today, but with the best of any sunshine across eastern Scotland. Western Scotland, Northern Ireland will hold on to the thicker cloud, the grey misty conditions, with even some patchy light rain. England and Wales, we've got some dense fog patches across northwest England, parts of Wales. Here they will likely linger over the next few hours, slowly clearing, but I think the best of the sunshine towards Midlands, Southern and Eastern England. Lighter winds in the southeast. We've lost the showers too. Temperatures today ranging from 11 to 14 degrees.
Stav, thank you. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 13th of November. Good morning, if you're just joining us. The headlines. A Church of England bishop has told this programme that some senior colleagues may well have to resign over the child abuse scandal that forced Justin Welby to quit as Archbishop of Canterbury. Ministers are being warned that plans to sack underperforming NHS managers and to publish hospital league tables risk demoralising staff. Health and Social Care Secretary Wes Streeting joins us live in 10 minutes' time. And Donald Trump has given the tech billionaire Elon Musk a role in his new administration. He's been asked to cut government spending and slash red tape. The BBC News is coming up.
Also in this hour, we're speaking to the author Samantha Harvey, who's won the Booker Prize for her novel about a group of astronauts on the International Space Station, but nearly gave up on writing it.
I thought, why on earth would anybody want to hear from a woman at her desk in Wiltshire writing about space, imagining what it's like being in space when people have actually been there?
The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
Some survivors of abuse at the hands of John Smythe have called for senior clergy in the Church of England who knew about his behaviour to join the Archbishop of Canterbury in standing down. Justin Welby resigned yesterday after being criticised for failing to ensure allegations against Smythe were thoroughly investigated. One vicar has predicted Archbishop Welby's departure could be the beginning of what he called a clear-out. Here's our religion editor, Ali McBool.
Already, survivors of John Smythe's abuse, who did feel Justin Welby should step down for not doing enough and not earlier acknowledging what they'd been through, are asking questions about other clergy implicated. Four sitting bishops were named in the review of the church's handling of the case as knowing about the abuse long before it was made public and before it came to an end. Among them, the Bishop of Lincoln, Stephen Conway, has issued an apology for not taking further action, but later said that action should mainly have been to push for the office of Archbishop Welby to do more. Some survivors have asked for more resignations, and not just for the poor handling of John Smythe, but the cases of other abusers as well.
The Bishop of Birkenhead and Deputy Lead Bishop for Safeguarding, Julie Connolly, told this programme there may well be other people who should resign.
What frustrates me is that we still have this institutional problem where we are not putting victims and survivors at the centre. And so in some ways, we are not a safe institution. And that is so frustrating to those volunteers who work as parish safeguarding officers, for those people in parishes and chaplaincies who are doing all that they can.
League tables are to be introduced for hospitals in England. Managers who persistently fail to improve performance won't get pay rises or will be replaced. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, says his plans mean there will be no more turning a blind eye to failure. Two NHS organisations have expressed concern about the approach. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
In his first set-piece speech on NHS reform, Mr Streeting will say he aims to ensure every penny of extra investment in England's health service will be well spent and will cut patient waiting times. Senior health managers who don't meet targets and improve patient care will be denied wage increases. The best performing trusts will be given more funding for buildings and equipment and control over how to use it. Failing organisations will be scrutinised and managers may be replaced. Hospital league tables will be published based on a range of performance indicators, which have yet to be fully spelt out. Trusts will be barred from hiring agency staff in some roles, including junior healthcare assistants. Mr Streeting will speak at a conference run by NHS providers representing trusts, which has warned that league tables could bring unintended consequences. Another employers group, the NHS Confederation, said staff should not be made to feel they were being named and shamed.
The president of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, Dr. Adrian Boyle, told us that the league tables could hurt staff morale.
It is good to have some form of accountability. There's a difference between the intent and the way they do it. There is a risk that this will demoralise staff, and you will see that in poorly performing areas, recruitment and retention of staff, and that will go right down to clinical staff, will become even harder.
Donald Trump has given the world's richest man, Elon Musk, the role of cutting red tape and government spending in his new administration. Mr. Musk will work alongside the businessman Vivek Ramaswamy, one of Mr. Trump's former rivals for the Republican presidential nomination. A presenter on the television channel Fox News has been nominated to serve as defense secretary. Our North America editor Sarah Smith reports from Washington.
Donald Trump is making clear he intends to entirely reshape the American government by appointing Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy to drastically reduce government spending, slash regulation, and dismantle government bureaucracy. Mr. Trump has described the new Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, as the New Manhattan Project. That was the US program to develop nuclear weapons in the 1940s. That's an indication of how dramatic he hopes the impact of their work will be. Mr. Trump has also named Peter Hegseth as defense secretary. He's an Army combat veteran who spent the past 8 years working as a presenter on Fox News. He has no experience in government, and Mr. Hegseth may run into opposition from senior military leaders and might struggle to have his appointment confirmed in the Senate. But the president-elect is demanding the next Republican Senate leader should call recesses during which he can sidestep the usual confirmation process for his candidates.
Hundreds of job losses are expected to be announced this morning by the post office as part of a restructuring. The positions are understood to be going from the head office. The 115 remaining Crown sites are under threat of closure too. The new chairman of the post office, Nigel Railton, wants to ensure sub-postmasters get a greater revenue share. Thames Water says it has support from three quarters of its creditors for an emergency funding deal that could provide £3 billion to stabilise the company in the short term. The 75% figure is important as it's the minimum threshold needed for the plan to be approved by a court. That could happen next month. A review of how train companies enforce their fares is expected to be ordered by the government. BBC News understands the Transport Secretary, Louise Hague, will ask the rail watchdog to investigate the use of criminal prosecutions. There are concerns some passengers are being treated too harshly. Here's our transport correspondent, Sean Dilley.
Train companies have several options for dealing with ticketless passengers, from handing them penalty fares to private prosecution. But I've been told of serious concern in government that the criminal justice system is being used disproportionately to punish passengers who've made innocent mistakes. The BBC understands that, as a result, the Transport Secretary Louise Hague is to commission an independent review by the rail regulator, the Office for Rail and Road. The review will examine how clear ticketing terms and conditions are and how they are communicated to passengers. Critically, it will ask when prosecution is the right option.
For the first time, a novel set in space has won the Booker Prize. At just 136 pages long, Orbital, by the British writer Samantha Harvey, is also the second shortest book to win the prestigious award. It recounts a single day on board the International Space Station as the astronauts and cosmonauts see 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets. The chairman of the judges, Edmund Duval, explained why the story was the unanimous choice of the panel.
This is a completely miraculous novel. It's a beautiful meditation on how we all belong together, I think. And its prose is completely crystalline. It's just lyrical. But there's a kind of acuity to it, a kind of accuracy to it, a kind of thinking aloud about it, which we all were totally gripped by.
The mystery surrounding a tame beluga whale, once thought to have been trained as a Russian spy, may finally have been solved. Fishermen in Norway became suspicious when the white whale swam up to them 5 years ago. Now a marine scientist, who was working in Russia at the time, has told the BBC she's certain the whale escaped from a military facility in the Arctic. Here's our environment correspondent, Jonah Fisher.
When a whale wearing a harness approached a fishing boat on Norway's northern coast, speculation swirled that it was a Russian spy whale. In a new BBC documentary, a specialist in beluga whales, Dr. Olga Spak, has shone new light on this murkiest of marine mysteries. She says it's common knowledge among her former colleagues in Russia that a whale named Andruha had at the time escaped a military training program based in the Arctic, where the whales may have been protecting submarines. Andruha went on to become a celebrity in Norway, where he was renamed Hvaldimir and spent a summer living in a harbour, delighting visitors with his tricks.
And the documentary Secrets of the Spy Whale is available on iPlayer and is on BBC Two at 9 o'clock tonight.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It's just coming up to 8:10. Here's a headline in The Guardian. Government unveils hospital league tables. The first paragraph reads thus. The government has revealed the performance ratings of every major hospital in England, naming and shaming a dozen trusts as the worst performers in the NHS. Ah, but wait a second. The article's actually from the 25th of September 2001, a time when Health Secretary Wes Streeting was limbering up for Freshers Week. Those reforms, introduced by a former Health Secretary, Alan Milburn, were largely ditched in 2005. Now they're largely back, as is Mr. Milburn, who is advising the new Labour government. And this time the ideas include a new pay system for senior managers to stop pay rises for those trusts that are not performing, financial rewards for those trusts that do perform well, league tables of hospitals published, and a sharp reduction in the number of agency staff hired. This is the reform part of the government's NHS strategy. comes at a time when MPs are soon to be invited to vote on assisted suicide, a potentially huge social reform in this country. And we're joined now by Wes Streeting, the Health and Social Care Secretary. Mr. Streeting, good morning.
Good morning.
I want to give you a chance first to spell out your thinking, why you think these league tables will work before we explore the trade-offs and the objections. What is your thinking?
Good morning. So firstly, we saw the investment at the budget, biggest capital allocations to the NHS since Labour was last in government, the biggest cash increase for any public service. And we said that alongside the investment would come reform. Today's package of announcements is about making sure we've got great leadership in every part of our NHS, driving up standards right across the country. There's understandable emphasis on the tough love end of the spectrum, particularly management of poor performance, managing people out of the NHS in senior leadership positions who consistently underperform. But we also should take a moment to name and praise and recognise the difference that great leadership can have. If you take my own local trust, Barking, Havering and Redbridge, it's been in and out of special measures over the years, constantly known as a troubled trust, big impact on staff morale and most importantly, patient outcomes. We've got a great leader now in Matthew Traynor, who's built a really strong team. So it's now known as one of the fastest improving trusts in the country. And some of the reform they are leading, for example, the way in which they are busting through the backlog with reformed ways of working, is some of the most leading work in the whole country.
Okay, and good on them. I mean, that does sound impressive. We'll look into that. But of course, as you know, people in the sector are very concerned about, as you say, the other end of it, the staff who don't like this. So an hour ago, we spoke to Dr. Adrian Boyle, who you'll know, president of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine. And this is what he said. He said, there's a risk this will demoralise staff. And you'll see that in poorly performing areas, recruitment and retention, right down to clinical staff, will get even harder. What do you say to that?
There's nothing more demoralising than going to work, busting a gut for your patients and knowing that despite your best efforts, you're letting them down because you're not given the tools to do the job.
Well, there might be if your name's put out in public and someone is underperforming.
You're working in a context where you are not given the tools to do the job and you've got poor leadership. And look, on urgent and emergency care, for example, there is a wide variation across NHS performance, ranging from 83% of people in one trust being seen within 4 hours in type 1 A&Es, right down to 38.2%. That's over 44 percentage points difference. And what we need to understand is in those poorest performing areas, is that because of wider contextual challenges, wider system challenges? And if so, let's provide the national support in to fix those fundamental problems in the system so we don't keep on in that doom loop of underperformance. But where we have poorly performing senior managers, I'll make no apology for managing those people out because people know, and this is the guilty secret of the NHS. There are very senior managers who are paid on average, let's not forget, £145,000 a year, who are managed out, given a payoff in one trust, and then reincarnate in another NHS trust. And those might be the rotten apples, and I want to recognise that there are some outstanding leaders right across the NHS, but those rotten apples are unacceptable
okay,
and
let
give
me,
the rest of the profession
me.
A bad name. So we've got to manage those out, as well as investing in leadership development training, and crucially, setting free the highest performers so we have less top-down, less centralisation, less management by diktat from the centre. And as I'm arguing in my speech today, as we empower the front line, as we push more power, resources and decision making closer to the front line, we will shrink the centre.
Okay, I want to forgive me for interrupting, but I mean that we got a lot of the speech there, and I do want to put some questions to you, if I may. Isn't the truth that what you really need is the best people to go to the worst performing areas and trusts?
100%.
But why would they do that if the trusts were highlighted as a place which was A, going to be punished financially if it underperformed, and B, was that was made public?
Because we're going to incentivise people to do precisely that.
How? By paying them more?
Absolutely. Where we've got the worst performing areas and areas that have been consistently challenged, even when the NHS has been performing at its best, there are parts of the country that have been consistently challenged because of wider system pressures. We will incentivise the best leaders to go into those areas. Well, financially. And that's part of the quid pro quo of today. I am very comfortable with paying exceptional leaders good salaries to go in and do a great job. What I'm not prepared to do is pay high salaries for poor performance and to pay people off only for them to turn up somewhere
else. When this
was
last tried, it was a Labour government who ditched it. Patricia Hewitt did that, I think, as a health secretary. Why would these sorts of reforms succeed now if they were ditched in the past?
Well, I don't think Patricia Hewitt ditched That focus on performance and making sure that we invest in our leaders, making sure that we have the right accountability in place. In fact, you know, you started off in 2001. Let's not forget that by 2010, we had the shortest waiting times and the highest patient satisfaction in history. The mystery here isn't why am I learning from the best of New Labour, updating it and going further and faster for the 2020s. The question is, why for 14 years did we have a Conservative government that took the golden inheritance they received, torched all of our reforms, did the botched Lansley reforms, and then through all of the progress we made into reverse. That was settled at the general
election.
And
it's a question you asked. It's not a question I was asked. But it's a familiar technique to ask a question that you want to answer in response to a different question. I get that. Let's turn to assisted suicide if we can. As I understand it, your position is that you're not minded to vote for reforms because you want to, first of all, make sure that palliative care is as good as it could be in this country. Can I just ask you a specific question on that? Do you think that palliative care can get good enough, quickly enough, for that not to be a bar, in your mind, to the legalisation of assisted suicide?
Yes, and that's part of it. I mean, I also set out some concerns about coercion and how people might be coerced into taking their own lives, and not, by the way, just through malevolent intentions on the part of people with a vested interest and something to gain from someone's untimely death, but also the extent to which people might feel themselves to be a burden on their loved ones, even where their loved ones would say that is very much not the case. That's why this issue is fraught with a number of ethical considerations as well as practical considerations. This is a finely balanced judgment as far as I'm concerned. I'm definitely voting against the bill, but I have enormous respect for colleagues who are taking a different view, and particularly enormous respect for the way in which Kim Leadbeater is leading this process and leading the debate.
Okay,
and I think in the coming weeks we'll see Parliament at its best as we engage with this
and
bill.
And we're trying to make sure we treat this with the sort of the necessary exactitude, as you can understand in the tone, because lots of our listeners will have different views on it. One of the issues with palliative care is what's going on in Britain's hospices. And about a year ago, I spoke to Brad McLean, the chair of trustees for East Anglia Children's Hospice, and he sent us this voice note about the state of palliative care in the UK. I wonder if you could just have a listen to it and then respond.
We're drastically underfunded through our statutory sources. At East Anglia's Children's Hospices, we receive 16% of our required funding through our local ICBs and the Children's Hospices grant. For 2025, we received no indication the Children's Hospice grant will continue, for that is worth over £1 million, or that any funding at all will come from the NHS or government sources for 2025. Without the generosity of our communities, hospices in this country just wouldn't exist, and further pressure would be on the NHS to find ways to help children, adults and families at the most difficult times of their lives. Hospices save the NHS money, are more efficient, agile, able to offer a much greater level of holistic support for families and children with life-limiting conditions and at the end of their life. With hospices coming close to being at breaking point, closing sites and making difficult decisions with no security of their future, what confidence and assurances can we be given to allow us to plan for 2025 and beyond?
The point that he makes there, Brad McLean, thank you to Brad McLean, who's given us that voice note at short notice. The point he says, Mr. Streeting, is that many hospices don't know about their funding for 2025 and beyond. So can I ask you a very specific question? I know you're looking into this and I know you're concerned about the state of our hospices. Can you confirm this morning that hospices will be exempt from the rise in employer national insurance, which was announced by Rachel Reeves in the budget?
There won't be an exemption in that way, but I am, one of the reasons I haven't yet announced the allocation for hospices is I'm looking very carefully at what we can do through the hospice grant to recognise that pressure and also recognise the underlying challenge that was set out there about the balance of state and statutory funding versus charitable contributions. What was described there, and brilliantly put, by the way, I agreed with every single word that was said, it is a reflection of the dire state of the hospice sector.
So why don't you do what he really wants, which is help him with his funding in the short term, take off the pressure which your government has added to very significantly in the budget with the moves on minimum wage. And obviously, we understand the case for that, but the move on business rates, the move on minimum wage and employer national insurance. I know you're part of a cabinet and I know there's collective responsibility, but why can't you say to Brad McLean and all the people in this country who work in hospices, who are looking after dying people, that you will exempt them from the rise in employer national insurance, which could send many of them out of business?
Well, firstly, let me say on the employer national insurance decision that the Chancellor made, without the decision that she took, we would not be able to invest in our NHS, as well as our other public services, in the way that the Chancellor has spelled out. And it is all very well our political opponents complaining about that decision, but they don't complain about the investment. And if they don't agree with how we're raising the money, then welcome to opposition. As we found, you have to say out how, spell out how you would find the
yes,
money.
Yes, but Brad
instead.
McLean's not your and political Brad, opponent, no, as
for,
you
for,
say.
For Brad, let me just say, and for people in that position, I think the Chancellor has taken a tough but necessary decision on employers' national insurance. I recognise the pressures that places on parts of the health and care sector. That's why I'm looking through very carefully the allocations that we make across health and social care to make sure that we can deliver the reform agenda and the improvements.
So when are you
going to,
I know you're busy, I know you're
budget.
A very, very busy man, but when are you going to have some news for people who work in the hospice sector in this country, like Brad, who has just said, and we're talking in November 2024, that they don't know about their funding for 2025, that they're utterly, utterly reliant on the benefaction of generous communities, on their retail charity outlets, and they frankly don't know whether or not they can keep people alive as soon as next year. What can you say about when you'll have some news for them?
Yeah, we'll make an announcement on the hospice grant before Christmas, because I recognise that people need to be able to make decisions about the next financial year. But the hospice grant will continue. I'm looking carefully at the pressures in the sector, which, by the way, aren't just those you mentioned, but the underlying conditions that Brad describes. Okay. And I just say generally, I'm not going to duck these challenges. I know these are difficult issues. I would just say to people, there is an enormous challenge across health, social care, the rest of the public sector and the public finances. That is why we are making difficult choices. That's why the choices the Chancellor made at the budget were the right one. We're not going to be able to fix 14 years of failure overnight, but we are getting on with the job, delivering the investment and the reform that our health and social care system needs.
He'll be pleased to know, as many people were, that you're going to make an announcement before Christmas. Thank you for confirming that.
Thank you.
Final question. You're an Anglican, as I understand it, member of the Church of England. Are you pleased that the Archbishop of Canterbury has resigned?
Pleased is probably not quite the right word.
Was it the right decision?
I feel it was absolutely the right decision. And I sort of feel a deep sense of shame about the failures of the Church of England. These cases of abuse within the church, actually within other contexts, and the failure of people to act and for institutions to act when serious allegations of abuse are made. This is happening time and time and time again. So it is right that the Archbishop of Canterbury has taken responsibility for his failures and the failures of the church overall. What I would say, and I'm speaking as an Anglican, not as a government minister, what I would say to other leaders of my church is that don't think that one head rolling solves the problem. There are deep and fundamental issues of not just practice, but culture on safeguarding that needs to be taken seriously. And I want to commend the Bishop of Newcastle for having the courage to speak up, because the conspiracy of silence has been part of the problem. The culture of cover-up has been part of the problem on serious abuse allegations for far too long. And I'm glad that the Archbishop of Canterbury has taken responsibility. I have enormous respect for him on a whole number of fronts, and I respect the decision that he has taken, but he's right to acknowledge his own failures and to take responsibility for the failure of the church overall.
Wes Streeting, I know it's a very busy day for you. Thanks for joining us, Health and Social Care Secretary Wes Streeting. Thank you.
At 24 minutes past eight, I can say we're joined by a writer and a trophy right now, because a book that covers 24 hours in the lives of six astronauts in orbit as they experience the wonder of Earth from space has won this year's Booker Prize. Orbital by Samantha Harvey was praised by judges for its ambition and beauty. The first woman to win what's considered the UK's most prestigious prize for a work of fiction since 2019, Samantha was also the only British writer on the shortlist. And she has walked in with a wonderful trophy. Good morning.
Morning, Emma.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Does it feel real?
It's beginning to feel real, yeah. Yesterday I was a blathering, stammering, shocked wreck. This morning I am still shocked. I did sort of think, have I woken up to find out that it's Booker Prize announcement day again?
And it's not me.
It's not, I think.
But it's real, it's happening. It's real. And I believe you wrote this book during successive lockdowns.
Most of it, yeah. I did start the book before COVID happened, but a lot of the book was written during lockdowns, yeah, which was quite apposite because, well, partly because it was beautiful escapism, yeah. But also because it's about six people trapped in a very small space together who cannot get to their loved ones and who are having to sort of witness what's happening from a remove.
And what were you trying to capture, and why do you think it struck a chord?
I wanted to write about the Earth, really. I mean, it is a book that's set in space, in low Earth orbit. I wanted to write something that felt like space realism. It was about kind of daily domestic human life in space rather than sci-fi. And it was quite interesting that that's not really written about, or we don't make films about it and so on. But mainly my focus was the Earth. I wanted to write something that was sort of could encapsulate both the absolute beauty and wonder and awe of that view of the Earth from a short sort of distance of low Earth orbit, but they could also look at it in the round and sort of take in issues of climate change and so on, and you know, the human impact on the Earth.
And you were looking, was this right, of a feed yourself while writing it? Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, there's some magnificent footage of the Earth from space. You thankfully don't have to go there, because I not only don't have the opportunity, but nor the guts. So everything I did was just looking at videos online and the ISS live feed, which works about 25% of the time. I don't know how it is they can keep the ISS up there so magnificently where they can't run a live stream. So I spent thousands of hours watching that footage and trying to map the book based on that footage.
Because, I mean, there's also some people say they look at things like that sometimes to, if they're having a hard time, to remind themselves of how big the world is and how small we are.
Yeah, but also interestingly, from there, the Earth does look big, but it also looks kind of very intimate and close, and you can start to see the different continents passing below you almost as a series of parks or gardens. You know, it starts to feel very familiar and intimate when you've been looking at it for a while. So I think that's it. Often I found these strange dissonances where, you know, you sort of realise how tiny we are as a species, but also how very impactful and large and significant we are, and how significant our impact.
So the commercialisation of space travel will not be tempting you should an invitation come your way now as the prize winner.
I mean, each day that I'm asked that question, I give a different answer.
Okay, so where are you this morning?
I feel kind of tired, so no.
I don't fancy space today.
Not today.
I mean, I should say Orbital is it 136 pages long? Is
that something like that?
Something like that. It's the second shortest book to win the prize, which means I could possibly read it at the moment with some of our earlier waking hours of small children. But I think it's interesting, isn't it? What can bring people in? Why they go towards a book in the first place? And if they don't feel it's daunting, maybe they do go towards it.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it doesn't look daunting. I think it's somewhat denser than it looks. It's not the quick read.
I didn't mean it. It's quick. Really, but if you're being told, you know, a major tome to get through, you know, you can be a bit intimidated by that.
Yeah,
but of course,
yeah,
it's the beauty, the ambition of it is spoken about from the judges. I also love the fact that you nearly didn't go back to it, having started it and abandoned it, feeling like you were trespassing, having not been to space.
Yeah, that's right. I did. And I don't usually do that with my work. I usually commit to an idea. But with this one, I felt that I couldn't do it originally. Sorry. Yeah, I just felt that it wasn't something I could legitimately write about. You know, I've never been to space. I can never go. How could I even? I'm so unconstitutionally like an astronaut.
Well,
imagine my way there.
If that isn't a story about a book that was nearly not written that has now won an award to inspire anyone who's struggling with writer's block this morning or doesn't think they should keep going with something, I don't know what is. Did you swear on stage? Did you have a moment like that when receiving?
I was very restrained.
I knew you were, I read that you were concerned about how quite to respond, but huge congratulations. What are you going to do today? Are you going to just go around with your trophy?
Yeah,
just casually there.
Yeah, just walk up and down Oxford Street with my trophy.
That's a good start. Where to start when you are the Booker Prize winner? Samantha Harvey, thank you for paying us a visit to the Today programme.
Thank you so much.
Huge congratulations.
And it's called Orbital. I'm just going to say this again. We get told off, don't we?
No. I can't wait. We've certainly got that, and I'm definitely going to read it. 8:30, Samantha, congratulations. Here's Mike Williams with the sport.
And I've just looked up the ISS high-definition feed of planet Earth. That's me set for the rest of the day.
Fascinating. All of us.
Yeah, it's on right now. I'm going to have to tear myself away to briefly talk more terrestrial matters, because it is an important day in English football's journey to introduce a new independent regulator. As the Football Governance Bill receives its second reading in Parliament later, strengthened legislation to establish a body that will oversee the elite men's club game in England was relaunched by the government last month, and the House of Lords are set to scrutinise the proposals later today. Well, we heard from Rick Parry, chair of the EFL, earlier in the programme, talk of his hopes that a full-scale review of the game by the new regulator could help break years of deadlock between the EFL and the Premier League over their respective financial futures. But what is the view of the Premier League clubs? Well, Paul Barber is deputy chairman and chief executive at Brighton and Hove Albion, and delighted to say he joins us on the programme now. Morning, Paul.
Good morning, Mike.
So it appears, doesn't it, that one of the disputed areas in this bill surrounds parachute payments, which, for those who don't know, are payments the Premier League makes to clubs over 3 years after they've been relegated. Some believe, don't they, that this makes the Championship an uneven playing field, and that this bill will give the independent regulator the power to assess these payments. They're not going to abolish them, just scrutinise their impact. That's a good thing, isn't it?
I think it depends on where you sit in that particular debate. I think if you're a club in the Premier League that is at risk of relegation in any given season, parachute payments are a necessary element of your business planning. You know, we want the Premier League to be and continue to be the most competitive league it can be. If you're one of those clubs that has a risk of relegation and you have a threat to your future, if you invest in players, if you invest in long-term contracts, then there's a danger that you won't do that if the parachute payments are not there. And if you don't do that, that could affect the competition within the Premier League. And if that happens, the value of the Premier League could diminish. And that's not good, obviously, for the clubs in the Premier League, but it's not good for the whole of football, because £1.6 billion gets distributed from the Premier League in each broadcast cycle, which benefits clubs at every level of the pyramid, and also wider areas of football too. So we've got to be really careful that we don't start meddling with something that's been hugely successful. It's the world's favourite football competition and actually feeds the rest of the game.
This is about the whole of English football. As you say, Paul, the new regulator would oversee the top five tiers of the football pyramid. And whilst you and others might argue that changing parachute payments will affect the competitiveness of those teams at the very top, the fact at the other end of the scale is that 11 EFL clubs have gone into administration in the last 13 years, and two of them have gone out of existence altogether. And I guess supporters of those teams probably don't care so much about whether the club 13th in the Premier League has an extra £30 million to spend on a new player.
I think we need to be clear that everybody loves the English football pyramid. We all do, including clubs in the Premier League. It's an incredible asset to our country. It's revered across the world, and nobody wants to see any football club go into administration or worse, liquidation. But the reality is that we've had seven liquidations since 1945. We've only had half a dozen administrations in the past decade. All of those clubs are still alive and relatively well. You know, we are not looking at a systematic crisis here. You know, there are many other industries in the country that have far more significant problems than football. That's not to say we've got everything right. You know, we've got things wrong in the past. This whole regulator debate has come about because we've made missteps. So we're not perfect, but we shouldn't be too quick to meddle with something that's been hugely successful for many, many, many decades and has sustained hundreds of football clubs throughout that time, all the way down, way beyond the professional pyramid into even lower leagues. So we've got to be careful that there aren't unintended consequences of introducing regulation to an industry that is very largely successful.
Just briefly, Paul, are you confident that the two leagues, the Premier League and the EFL, can agree a financial deal? Because worth saying, if they can't, this new regulator, if the bill passes, will be able to step in and enforce a settlement.
Well, that's a real concern that a backstop power exists there, because that disincentivizes a deal between the football authorities and in particular the EFL, who obviously are going to be working very hard to get the best deal they can for their clubs. But at the moment, already 16% of our revenue is distributed throughout the pyramid. And obviously we work every single day to try and find a way forward that improves the distribution to the rest of the pyramid, but at the same time gives Premier League clubs the chance to be competitive and to keep the system as fluid and as competitive as possible at the top end.
All right, great to get your perspective this morning. Many thanks for speaking to us ahead of the second reading of the Football Governance Bill in the House of Lords this afternoon. That is Paul Barber, Chief Executive at Brighton & Hove Albion.
Go and enjoy the space feed now.
Well, still on. Loving it.
You're still with it. Okay, good. Let's hear from Dr. Sean Williams with details of this morning's life-changing.
Today, a story of a self-confessed wild child of the 60s, a woman who danced with a cast of Hair on Broadway, loved Joni Mitchell and travelled to India to embrace the hippie culture. All of which was accompanied by bouts of sudden sadness and confusion over why, until a revelation in her 70s about an event in her childhood that had changed the whole trajectory of her life. Life-changing on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. After the news at 9.
Quick look at the weather. Today, cloud will move in for much of Scotland, Northern Ireland and parts of Northern England and Northern Wales, with patchy light rain towards the northwest.
We might be looking at space, but stay with us here on Earth, listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett. And at 23 minutes to 9, we're also here with Alan Smith, who's got a summary of the news.
Some survivors of abuse in the Church of England are calling for further resignations after the departure of Justin Welby as Archbishop of Canterbury. He quit yesterday, saying he must take personal and institutional responsibility for the failure to alert the authorities about the crimes of John Smythe. The second most senior cleric in the church, the Archbishop of York, Stephen Cottrell, told us safeguarding people in such a vast organisation was a challenge he was determined to meet. League tables are to be introduced for hospitals in England. Managers who persistently fail to improve performance won't get pay rises or will be sacked. On this programme, the Health Secretary Wes Streeting said there would be an emphasis on what he called the tough love end of the spectrum to ensure patients had the best care. Donald Trump has given the world's richest man, Elon Musk, the role of cutting red tape and government spending in his new administration. Pete Hegseth, a presenter on the television channel Fox News, has been nominated by Mr. Trump to serve as defense secretary. And a review of how train companies enforce their fares is expected to be ordered by the government. BBC News understands the Transport Secretary Louise Hague will ask the rail watchdog to investigate the use of criminal prosecutions.
Thanks very much, Alan. It's 22 minutes to 9. The Italian Prime Minister's plan to process migrants in Albania, you may be familiar with this, has hit another bump and could be delayed for more than a year as a European court deliberates. Giorgia Meloni's right-wing anti-immigration government's policy has been referred by Italian judges to the Court of Justice of the European Union after they ordered 7 Bangladeshi and Egyptian men held in Albania to be transferred to Italy. Other countries in Europe are questioning whether the Italy plan could be a model for them. Indeed, the Home Secretary here, Yvette Cooper, told us earlier this month she was watching very closely how the arrangement progressed. Well, in a moment, I'll talk to an MP in the Italian Prime Minister's party. But first, let me just speak to Megan Benton, Director of the International Programme at the Migration Policy Institute. Megan, could you just tell us about what this court has decided, what the immediate consequences are?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's exactly as you say, that lots of countries have been watching this with great interest, thinking it could be a blueprint for a more European approach. But while the centres are operationally functional, so they have capacity to process 3,000 migrants a month, the Italian government has faced a couple of legal challenges all around the issue of how to designate someone as being from a safe third country. That's needed in order to justify the detention in Albania. And initially, a couple of weeks ago, an Italian court applied a European Court of Justice case that says for a country to be designated as safe, it needs to be safe everywhere. That's a problem for specifically for Egypt and Bangladesh, where the migrants have been so far, been from so far. So Meloni, so she tried to overrule the Italian court. She issued a decree listing 19 safe countries. But as you say, they've referred that to the European Court of Justice. So the situation is that the migrants need to be brought to Italy, and essentially it's on hold.
And it could be for as long as a year.
It could be, yeah. There's a backlog of cases in the European Court of Justice. They could be fast-tracked, question mark about how quickly it'll get reviewed. But it's probably worth noting that EU countries are also right now working on what's called the Migration Pact, which will allow for EU-wide safe country of origin lists. And some people think that that might address the legal issues that Italy is now facing. There's a lot of desire for a more European approach and a lot of sort of interest in exploring what's often euphemistically called innovative solutions. That's kind of EU speak for offshoring. And that was in the mandate given to the new Home Affairs Commissioner.
So in the meantime, do we have any idea what Italy's approach will be? Of course, we've heard many times from our new Prime Minister that it will be to smash the gangs.
Well, I mean, it's worth saying that Italy's approach is fairly comprehensive. So while they are experimenting with this offshore model, they are also coupling that with things like humanitarian corridors and expanding labour migration. And I see this as part of a broader trend, actually on both sides of the Atlantic, away from territorial asylum and further restrictions, but also thinking about expanding legal pathways. There's a lot of interest, I say, from many European countries. But when it comes to this disembarkation issue, so how you solve the problem in the Mediterranean, we really are grappling with a lot of sort of operational, legal and ethical challenges. And it's hard to see how to overcome those. I mean, one issue, as you know, one reason why this model is so different from the UK Rwanda deal is that it's trying to separate out vulnerable groups and women and children, etc., at sea. But just to do that more nuanced triaging on a boat at night, it's likely to create a lot of challenges. And one of the issues already with the group that was taken to Albania is that they had health concerns or they weren't of adult age. That also points to possible legal obstacles ahead.
Let me bring in, that's Megan Benton from the Migration Policy Institute. Thank you. Let me bring in Giacomo Calavini, an MP in Italian Prime Minister Meloni's party, the Brothers of Italy, who sits on the country's Foreign Affairs Committee. Good morning. What is your reaction to this being referred to this European court?
Good morning. But let me start from the beginning and then made one step back or maybe two, because the issue of migrants has been an unsolved problem in Europe for several years. We can't forget, for example, what happened in 2015, just to remember, arrive in Europe more than 1 million of migrants after the terrible crisis in Syria. But, and this is the point, more than 1 million of people arrive in Europe managed by the illegal organization. Every nation in Europe has not been able to tackle the problem, to face the problem. For example, UK, I remember the agreement with Rwanda. And the problem for a country like ours, like Italy, it has been even more difficult. And I want to clear with you, we are not against the migrants. Italy is a country with 5 or 6 million of extra EU people, often perfectly integrate, but we are against illegal immigration. And so, if I can answer to your question, we are really shocked in Italy. That I think the people is really shocked after the sentence from some Jews, because when Giorgia Meloni arrived in Palazzo Chigi, your downing street, she has put the migrant issue in Brussels on the European table. And politics is made of photographs. And if I may, I want to remember President von der Leyen in Lampedusa with Meloni to see the crisis that Italy had to face alone for many years.
Can I just come in at this point? Looking to bypass rules whereby you process migrants onshore in Italy, does that now look like you can't do that because of what's happened here?
It's really important for us to try to face in this problem. We are trying to do with many agreements to stop the illegal immigration with some country in North Africa. And I think in what we have done, for example, in Tunisia, in Egypt, with Europe. And at the same time, we are trying to help some country in Africa with the ambitious Mattei plan. And for us, it's really important to try to follow the way of the agreement with Albania, because we have to remember that this agreement serves to alleviate the problem of managing illegal immigration in Italy, and at the same time serve to discourage the arrival of migrants in Italy and in Europe too.
Gian Giacomo Calavini, thank you.
Time now is 8:45. What is going on and what is at stake in Kursk, the region in western Russia, where the Ukrainian military has made significant gains? President Zelensky says his country's troops are holding down some 50,000 Russian troops in that region. And curiously, it appears that Russia has turned to North Korea in recent times, with perhaps around 10,000 North Korean troops being deployed by Russia, not in the east of Russia, near the border of North Korea, but in the west of Russia, in Kursk, near to Ukraine. Let's speak now to Matthew Saville, Director of Military Sciences at RUSI, the think tank. Matthew, good morning.
Morning.
What is going on, as far as we know? What's the actual situation in Kursk, as far as we know?
I mean, that's a good question. And a lot of what we get from our understanding, or how we get our understanding, is from open sources and sort of partial briefings. And obviously the Ukrainians will be quite cagey about how they brief some of that. But so far as we can tell, Russian forces are now pressing much more fiercely on the Ukrainian forces that have embedded themselves in Kursk. And that pressure has been there for a couple of months, actually. But they have been bolstered by the arrival of these North Koreans, of which there is now some evidence that they are on the front line. And Ukrainians seem to have, over the past month or so, lost about half of the territory that they took. But what you haven't got is a sort of huge Russian counteroffensive. This is still fairly gradual pressure.
But, I mean, Ukraine, what's the sort of overall situation with Ukraine? Obviously, constantly seeking support from the UK and other sort of allies, and also from Donald Trump's America. But how depleted is Ukraine's military and personnel?
So Ukrainians are generally reluctant to release information on their casualties, and we generally get much more, hear much more about the Russians. And I think the chief of the defense staff the other day said the Russians had now suffered over 700,000. The Ukrainians have lost much fewer troops than that, but they're still considerable, and they are climbing. And the overall position is that they are now under fairly significant pressure in multiple places across the front. And the main Russian advance is in the east, out of Donetsk, but they're also now pushing up from the south, around Zaporizhia, and indeed are sort of taking back the fairly meagre gains that the Ukrainians made in their own counteroffensive in 2023.
And in those places, places like Zaporizhia and Donetsk, is it sort of done? I mean, is it over? Have Russia got those bits of land and basically they're going to keep it? It would take a phenomenal effort from Ukraine, which it currently doesn't have the personnel or the political power to do, to reclaim that land. So should we basically be thinking that parts of Ukraine have indeed been ceded to Russia?
So I don't think that's the case along the very front, but it is inevitably the case that the longer that territory remains in Russian hands, the more opportunity they have to build up defences. Yes. And so one of the problems for the 2023 counteroffensive is that they were going into the teeth of long prepared defences. What Russia is taking now is obviously it's much newer. They haven't yet dug in, but they are destroying cities and towns. And so places like Pokrovsk are being, even though they haven't taken all of Pokrovsk yet or Turetsk, these places have been leveled by Russian artillery and other firepower. The big issue for the Ukrainians, set aside the question of materiel supply and specialist weapons, is that at the moment it doesn't sound like they can mobilize, recruit and train enough troops
right,
to build up their forces. So they're not losing vast tracts of land at the moment, but what they are is steadily losing their ability to hold, or indeed facing tough decisions about whether they should pull back to consolidate on more defensible lines.
Matthew Saville, Director of Military Sciences at RUSI, the think tank. Thank you very much indeed.
It's 11 minutes to nine. Now, fashion shows can be at their best pure acts of theatre and a comment on the world around them. One cannot get away from the fact that they are ultimately commercial vehicles to sell clothes and a brand, a label, to consumers. Given that most people do not get to watch them live in the room where they happen, a new collaboration between the style bible Vogue and an immersive venue in King's Cross, London, called The Light Room, has resulted in a new video installation using archive material to tell the story of the history of the runway and features some of the most iconic fashion shows. I was invited for an exclusive preview and I spoke to the British head of Vogue, Cho Minardi, about the fashion industry today. But first, I spoke to the executive curator of the installation, David Sable, and asked what makes shows in this Lightroom venue different.
Nobody who's a shape is ever going to be a fashion designer.
Lightroom is an immersive space for projection-based storytelling. It's one large room where we can project on all four walls and the floor that allows us to really transport people into all different kinds of storytelling.
You've done Space before. You've done David Hockney, for those who've been lucky enough to see these shows, because they're shows in themselves. Why have you gone for the fashion show?
One of the things that will be really exciting for audiences about this experience, which is different from the kind of fashion exhibitions you might get at the V&A Museum, is that it has the ability to really transport you, to give you a feeling of the experience of the shows.
She really took the fashion show, she put it on a platform and she used it.
I'm now with the woman who runs British Vogue, Choma Nardi, who has been very involved with what we have just been witness to. Tell us, Choma, hello, welcome to the Today programme. What has been your role in this exhibition, this bonanza?
This is kind of a unique project because there's this element of documentary but animation. Even me, who's been to hundreds of shows, it was a different experience that you get in the Lightroom because you're completely immersed in it and you see things from all angles. I remember it was when I started to go into fashion, street style wasn't really a thing, and then suddenly the show outside of the show was a spectacle. And we only really touch on those things in this show because I think there's so many ways you can approach the show. You could do a whole show on the evolution of street style or the front row or backstage or casting, because models are so important to the story. But this is very much about the runway.
You talk about where fashion is now. You just mentioned models. There is a plateau in the use of bigger models. You'll be familiar with this. It's not going in the right direction. This is not Vogue's responsibility per se, but Vogue has a major role in how you reflect fashion. How concerned are you about skinny being back?
We should be all concerned. I am very concerned, and I know many of my colleagues are very concerned, and I do think perhaps Ozempic has something to do with it. We're in this moment where we're seeing the sort of pendulum swing back to skinny being in, and often these things are treated like a trend, and we don't want them to be.
Why do you think that's happening?
I don't think we can pin it on any one thing. I do think that Ozempic has something to do with it, because we're seeing a lot of celebrities who are
using it,
and I think there's this shift in the culture around how we think about our bodies and how we address our bodies.
Are you thinking of trying to do anything to address Ozempic?
I think it's important that all bodies are represented, but I think it's not something that we as a magazine can change on our own, because obviously the designers are making clothes that are sample size, and often it takes more
production. A sample size, just to be clear, is what in UK terms?
It's a six or a four, I would say. That is really worth talking about in fashion right now, because it is a real problem.
I suppose, have you noticed a change from brands as well?
I felt that this past season there was a lot of backsliding. There were certain brands who did really well and included non-sample size models, and there were certain models who have been on the cover of Vogue, like Paloma Elsesser and Precious Lee. But I didn't think there was enough representation as far as body diversity, and it felt almost like at certain shows the girls were especially thin, or the women, the models were especially thin.
It must be strange to see that going in that direction.
It is. Hopefully it's not something that will endure, and it's something that will, you know, hopefully this season will be a wake-up call, and it won't be that we see that progress, that kind of negative trend.
I remember how important your Nigerian roots are to you, and I'm very struck, you know, as the first black woman to run Vogue, we now have the first black woman running a major political party in the UK, and she's of Nigerian descent, Kemi Badenoch, of course. Does that give you a sense of pride?
I think it's great to see all women of colour in positions like that. We don't have to share the same values, but I do think it's great to see more representation.
Yeah, this is a real moment, I suppose, in some ways.
It is. It's a huge moment, and I think, I mean, I was very saddened to see that in the States that, you know, we've taken a step back as far as thinking about having a woman of colour in that position, and that saddens me. So I'm happy to see in other places where all women are being elevated. It just shows us that there's still a glass ceiling for women of all colours.
Just thinking of our listeners, maybe groggily waking up this morning, you talk about an art of getting dressed. They may not feel it's an art most mornings. And I thought perhaps you could tell us what it's like when you get dressed in the morning. Is this an art? How could we elevate ourselves like you, the head of British Vogue, Joma? Help us out.
I remember talking to Erica Badu about this because I do worry about what I'm going to wear for certain events. And I think quite carefully when I know that the world will be watching. I was like, how do you plan, you know, your stage outfits? And she's just like, well, I just pick up whatever's on the floor and it just depends on my mood. And I just thought, oh, I wish I was that free to just be like, I'll just throw this old thing on and walk out. I do want it to feel that way. So I think if you have that sense of freedom and spontaneity, that's the best, isn't it? You just like, that's when you're not even thinking about what you're wearing. I do, that's the goal, to not think about what I'm wearing so that I feel like I can be myself fully, because if I'm conscious of it, then I'm not in the right outfit. Yeah.
But people have a uniform as well, I suppose that's the other. So they do the opposite, just so they don't have to think.
I'll probably save myself several hours. Well, days of my life, maybe years of my life from worrying about what I'm going to wear.
I had to ask. Choma, thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.
It's 4 minutes to nine, and now for a story that is completely bonkers. Here goes. A beluga whale, an exquisitely beautiful milky silver cetacean that patrols the Arctic and subarctic waters, turns up next to a fishing boat off Norway's northern coast. It's wearing a harness, which arouses suspicion. And specifically, the suspicion that the whale, which is given the name Andruha, has escaped a Russian military training program where it may have been protecting submarines. It could be a so-called spy whale. But then Andruha becomes a celebrity in Norway, is renamed Hvaldimir, and spends his summer delighting locals in a popular harbour with various tricks. And finally, according to a new BBC documentary, which is on BBC Two in the iPlayer from 9 o'clock this evening, finally the mystery of who Andruha, also known as Hvaldimir, has been solved. You with us? Well, I hope so, because Jennifer Shaw, the director of Secrets of the Spy Whale, is hopefully going to explain all. Jennifer, did all that make sense to you?
Good morning, Amal. Yes. In fact, yeah, what you've talked about in terms of Hvaldimir's real name is one of the big reveals that comes out of the documentary that's airing tonight. I think until this point, no one around the world has known his real name, his real Russian name. He's been nicknamed Hvaldimir, as you said, which is a play on the Norwegian word for whale, Hval, and Demir coming from the first name of Vladimir Putin. That's been his nickname for the last 5 years. So that's actually one of the big discoveries we've made.
Nice to have a whaling scoop on the Today programme. Just briefly, had this been a spy whale, how would that have worked? How do whales do spying?
Well, this is one of two theories that we actually explore in the film. So as part of our research, we go back in time, 60 years into the past, looking at the very beginnings of marine mammal military training during the Cold War. And there was a rival program set up between the US and the Soviet Union. And we learn there that there are two different things that the whale could have been doing, either guarding submarines and surface vessels for Russia, or indeed, because they're able to dive so deep, they're well suited to surveying the seabed. And in fact, one of the discoveries we make in the film is that there are, in fact, beluga whale pens that you can view on satellite imagery next to a notorious spy submarine program in Russia called Gugi.
Wow. Okay. Briefly, what was Andruha, also now known as Hvaldimir, what was he up to?
Well, I think we leave it up to the viewers to decide, because we come up with these two credible theories and there is strong evidence for both of them. So it will be interesting to see what people think once they've watched the film.
But there was something, what was it he said, equipment of St. Petersburg, which gave something, a clue as to his origins.
That's right. So when he was spotted by fishermen in Norway, he was wearing a harness that had a mount on it that looked like it would have fit an underwater camera, okay.
It's which